of a young boy hiding behind his father in a barrel, ostensibly to avoid Israeli gunfire. The boy died, and they blamed the Israelis. Well, new evidence is coming out that actually the Palestinians shot that boy. It's an amazing story. I will show you the propaganda and the video Sunday at 6:30 p.m. on RadioInsideScoop.com. For now, this is Mark Levine signing off. Have a happy Thanksgiving, everyone.
This is the Quality News Network. Although the House passed a $50 billion spending bill for the Iraq War last night, which is tied to a troop withdrawal by the end of next year, Democratic leaders are uncertain about the bill's prospects in the Senate. They say they won't pay for war funding unless it's tied to a timetable for pulling out U.S. troops, a condition President Bush has insisted he will veto. Defense Secretary Robert Gates spoke to Congress today about what could happen if lawmakers do not pass a war spending bill. For example, he said there could be up to 100,000 layoffs at military bases. U.S. military officials in Iraq are criticizing the Iraqi government for failing to come together. The commander of day-to-day U.S. operations in Iraq says a window of opportunity has opened with the decrease in attacks. However, the Iraqi government has not agreed on a new power-sharing arrangement. The U.S. military says that in October, the number of roadside bombs in Iraq has dropped to the lowest figure since September of 2005. A U.S. general credits Iran's commitment to stop the flow of weapons into Iraq as the reason for the decrease. The U.N. Nuclear Watchdog Agency reports that Iran has generally been truthful about the main aspects of its nuclear history. However, the agency warns that its current knowledge of Tehran's atomic work is decreasing. It also finds that Iran continues to defy the U.N. Security Council demands to halt the enrichment of uranium, which is a key step in the production of nuclear weapons or energy. Former Pakistani Prime Minister Benazir Bhutto is trying to form an alliance with other opposition leaders. She wants to replace current President General Pervez Musharraf, who imposed emergency rule earlier this month. Musharraf appointed an interim prime minister to run the government until parliamentary elections are held in January. In a speech today, Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas called for the overthrow of the Hamas leaders in Gaza. Several strong aftershocks with a magnitude 6.2 and 6.6 struck northern Chile less than 24 hours after yesterday's 7.7 earthquake. About 15,000 people have been left homeless, 150 people were injured, and two were killed by the first quake. A powerful cyclone hit Bangladesh and forced more than 3 million people to flee their homes and head inland. You're listening to the Quality News Network, Science and Business next.
You know you can depend on QNN for honest news. Now we want you to know about an honest source of information on one of the country's most desirable vacation destinations, Carmel by the Sea on California's beautiful Central Coast. That source is the best address in Carmel, carmel.com. Just a few simple clicks and you're visiting a website that mirrors all that Carmel stands for. quality, character, tradition, beauty, the great outdoors by the sea, cultural heritage, and the best shopping, charming inns, superb dining, world-class art, music, and theater, a cornucopia of delights. So when you're planning your next getaway, go to the best address in Carmel, carmel.com, for tips on everything Carmel. Then put that information to good use by visiting Carmel by the Sea for an unforgettable getaway. Carmel.com.
A federal appeals court today voided the new mileage standards for light trucks that were set to go into effect next year. 11 states and environmental groups filed the lawsuit, which would have covered SUVs, minivans, and pickup trucks. President Bush announced a plan today to allow the airlines to use military airspace to relieve air traffic congestion over the Thanksgiving travel period. According to a report by a congressional advisory panel, the greatest threat to U.S. technology comes from Chinese spying in America. The group recommended counterintelligence efforts to prevent China from stealing U.S. expertise in manufacturing. The Labor Department reports that last week the number of workers filing for unemployment benefits went up to 339,000. That is up 20,000 from the previous week. London-based Barclays announced it will write down about $2.7 billion related to the U.S. subprime mortgage market. Gold is trading at $787.30 an ounce. Light sweet crude is trading at $93.43 a barrel on the New York Mercantile Exchange. At the close of Wall Street today, the Dow Jones was down 121 points, ending at 13,110. The NASDAQ was down 26 points, and the S&P 500 was down 19. There's always more at our website, qualitynewsnetwork.com. I'm Ali Dramoff.
Now, Head On with Bob Kincaid. Head On is brought to you every night by the West Virginia District Council of Carpenters and Millwrights. Union Carpenters and Millwrights, they're building the American dream. Free speech isn't free if you don't use it, so call Bob now at 1-877-4-HEAD-ON. That's 1-877-443-2366. Now, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy. You know what I love about doing this program? No matter how crappy the rest of the day goes, I know that for 3 hours of an evening, I get to shove it all to one side and spend 3 hours completely detached and disassociated from the rotten, evil crap outside that has nothing, no bearing on the show. And this is one of those days. About 3 hours ago, the day went completely down the toilet. I sit here, we talk about the things that go on, and you might as well tell you. I mean, Jesus. You know that I'm trying to get things all settled up with my father's estate in Alabama. I have a couple of really goofy, evil, wacky, weird, twisted, sick sisters. One of whom has decided to contest my father's will, and I found out about it today. And, you know, I'm a man of peace. I don't do, you know, but, Jesus, it was everything I could do not to put my foot through a door. Ugh. Ugh. You know, because I need this. Because I'm bored. Because there's no adventure in my life. Because, you know, I just sit around waiting for people to screw with me. So, you know, if I'm a little crabby or persnickety or snitty tonight, please bear in mind, it's not you guys. It's not even George W. Bush. It's my fundamentalist sister. Ugh. Family. You know, my father told me this would happen. And, you know, he was right. So they want to fight over a... Oh, God. Well, I'm going to let them fight. And when it's all... Oh, boy. Oh, boy, when it's over. You know, you guys have heard me have a fit on the air a couple of times. I'm going to just... Oh, all those fun little words that my mother... I would be ashamed to have my mother know I knew how to use. I'm going to use every last one of them, and some of them I'm going to use twice. So, you know, that's kind of what's behind, you know, if I'm not on, you know, exactly an even keel this evening. Beyond that, however, we do have a good show lined up for you this evening. We'll be joined in the next hour, about an hour from now, I hope, by the president of the West Virginia AFL-CIO, a gentleman whom I know by the name of Kenny Perdue. And he's going to update us on the AFL-CIO's association and efforts on behalf of the nurses at Appalachian Regional Hospital in Beckley and Hinton, and the general ARH strike that is underway even as we speak. My congressman, Nick Joe Rahal, issued a press release today commenting on the strike. Let me see if I can find where it's laying around here. Yeah, there it is. U.S. Representative Nick Rahal, DUWV, issued the following statement today in response to the continuing dispute between the nurses and management of the Appalachian Regional Healthcare Hospitals. He said, and I quote, "It is disconcerting that we are now in the seventh week of the dispute between the management and nurses of the ARH hospitals without a resolution. I am encouraged to see recent news reports indicating that some progress is being made in talks. As the holiday season approaches, I urge all parties to remain at the table and work in good faith to reach a fair agreement for our nurses that will ensure long-term access to quality health care for the people of Southern West Virginia." Thank you, Nick. I'd like to see something a little bit stronger, but I guess that's as good as we can get. So we will find out a little bit more about what's going on the strike and what the members of the West Virginia AFL-CIO are doing to help bring relief to those striking nurses who aren't out there, we want more money. No. They just want to not be screwed with. You know, that's the way it is with most strikes these days. When somebody finally, we live in a country, in a world that, a country. Because, like, in France, labor knows how to flex its muscle. It's been doing that lately. This right-wing Nicolas Sarkozy creep, you know, the guy that sat down to dinner the other night with George Bush. He is trying to impose new labor rules on the French people and the transport workers and everybody under the sun just said, okay, you want to do that? Here, we'll shut the country down for a couple of days. How do you like it, Nikki? Nikki Sarkozy. Is it good for you, buddy? Because, you know, we'll just shut the country down for a good long while if you want to keep up this crazy talk. Here in this country, no, not so much. We don't know how to do that anymore. So instead, when some organization finally gets pushed to the point where it has to strike, it's not because they need more money. It's usually because the company's trying to really put the wood to them, like, you know, take away their health care or make people work 16 hours a day who are holding other people's lives in their very hands. Which, in this case, happens to be the case. So I'm looking forward to talking to Kenny Perdue in the next hour. Of course, some portion of the program will be dedicated, as it always is, to conversations with you guys. Because this is conversation radio, for heaven's sakes. And I hope you'll chime in with whatever is burning you up, whatever bee is in your bonnet, whatever burr is under your saddle. Just let me know. for a starting place, the other thing we might do, I think it starts at 8 o'clock, so we might just sort of sneak in and see who's saying what. At 8 o'clock this evening Eastern Time, it's my understanding that the Democratic debate from Las Vegas will begin. Let me, 8 p.m. Eastern Time. And maybe for that hour or so, we'll listen in and scream and carry on together and listen, watch Wolf Blitzer do whatever it is that Wolf Blitzer is that certainly doesn't pass for journalism. We'll check that out. Now, I promised in some postings I made earlier in the day, I promised that I would make this high on the list for the program tonight. The CNN YouTube debate tonight, live from Las Vegas, you know, that city that is a howling at nature because they got no water, they got no energy, it's in the middle of a confounded desert. Anyway, it's coming to you from Vegas, I guess. Yeah, Vegas. And it's brought to you... Oh, hey! It's brought to you by Clean Coal Technology. Clean Coal, providing America's energy future and energy independence from foreign oil. Clean Coal, what you need. Not. So, I did what I could do. I made a call earlier today as soon as I saw this to try to let people who need to know in the Kucinich campaign know that this debate was being sponsored by and is a hustle for the continued destruction of the Appalachian Mountains. And I don't beg very well, but I fairly begged for Congressman Kucinich to please denounce this BS from the podium. This excuse for the continued war on Appalachia, be it West Virginia, be it Kentucky, Tennessee, Virginia, mountaintop removal, as we know, in Alabama, to at least let somebody on that stage let the world know that we're in on it and we know what a fraud it is. And in the course of doing so, I showed in the postings over at DU, I showed a couple of photographs of what it means, this mountain range removal. I believe, if I'm not mistaken, our news ninja, Susan, has also posted it on the show post and the blog at headonradionetwork.com. If you want to see a photograph that will absolutely flop your guts, have a look at Cayford Mountain and what they've done to it. It is, well, I cringe every time I see this photograph. Destruction and devastation as far as the eye can see, and this is shot from an airplane that can see clean to the horizon. It's amazing. And yet Americans will tune in to this debate and be told that clean coal is providing for America's future. And they'll probably have some little girl or something playing on an abandoned mine site. This is reclamation. Ugh. And the sad thing is, no matter how hard we try to get the message out about what this really, really means, there are millions of Americans who, Democrats, Republicans, Independents, the Greens probably know. But millions of Americans of all political stripe, all walks of life, who don't have the first flippin' clue what it means and where that clean call comes from. And so they'll... Don't bother turning off the lights over there, Eunice. It's power being provided by clean coal, and you know we got 1,000 years of coal left in America, so don't worry about the lights.
Ugh.
And, you know, from coal to a story that I've been trying to get to for a couple of days now. Fascinating little story about a loophole. I love that story about W.C. Fields in his latter days sitting with a blanket over his lap on a rocking chair on his front porch, obviously near the end of his days. And a friend comes by, and Fields is sitting there reading a Bible, and Fields, of course, was a noted atheist. And the guy said, "Fields, you old hellcat, you? What are you doing reading a Bible?" And Fields looks up and says, "Looking for a loophole." Well, there's another loophole out there, and nobody's looking for it because the people, the people had it put there. And, well...
If you don't eat your meat, you can't have any pudding! How can you have any pudding if you don't eat your meat?
Gotta eat your meat, right? Wrong. These people are going to turn me into a vegan yet. And God knows it would probably be the best thing that ever happened to me. A Chicago Tribune story by Stephen J. Hedges. One federal inspector calls it the E. coli loophole. Oh, God, I hope you're not eating dinner right now. Please tell me you're not eating dinner right now. This can't wait. It's two days I haven't gotten to this, and I'm absolutely committed to getting to this. One federal inspector calls it the E. coli loophole. Another says nobody would buy it if they knew. And you know how meat gets E. coli on it, right? You know how meat gets infected with E. coli. It's because the meat has been in poop, exposed to feces, as it were. I'm sorry, I know some of you listen while you're cooking dinner. God, I hope you're not fixing any beef right now. Jesus, I'm so sorry. The officials are referring to the little discussed fact that the U.S. Department of Agriculture has deemed it acceptable for meat companies, this is the Bush administration Department of Agriculture, you know, the guys who believe that the biggest problem with government is government, and that government can't work because they don't want government to work. This is the same group that brings you the Consumer Product Safety Commission, who it turns out, you know, the head of that organization has been flown all over from here to yonder on corporate jets, so she testifies to Congress a couple of weeks ago that no, she doesn't want any inspectors added, no, she doesn't need more money in her budget, thank you, it would be nice if we had less money in our budget, no, we don't need to inspect every blessed thing that comes from China, and, you know, so what if a baby dies once in a while from a poison piece of Chinese garbage? That Bush administration. The U.S. Department of Agriculture has deemed it acceptable for meat companies to cook and sell meat on which E. coli 0157H7, a bacteria that has been proven time and again to be absolutely toxic and frequently fatal to the human beings who consume it, it is acceptable for meat companies to cook and sell meat on which that E. coli is found during processing. I'll wait till the screaming subsides. Because I got my screaming out of the way a couple of days ago when I read this. The E. coli loophole affects... these numbers! The E. coli loophole affects millions! I didn't say... thousands, I didn't say hundreds, I said millions, millions of pounds of beef each year that test positive for the presence of E. coli 0157H7. It's a charming little bacteria, too, because children are particularly susceptible to it, and when they consume it, and when it infects them, it shuts their little kidneys down, and by the time they die, their heads are the size of basketballs. Because, when your kidneys shut down, well, kidney failure is a really, really, really nasty death.
Now, the USDA and the meat producers say, well, you know, it's not like we don't cook the meat. Cooking the meat destroys the bacteria and makes it safe to eat the bacteria as pre-cooked hamburgers, meatloaf, crumbled taco meat, and other products. You know, canned meat products. Canned, cooked meat products.
Ah, you know, the E. coli can't hurt you. It's dead. It's there, but it's dead. It can't hurt you anymore. You know, I've had some, and I think it just, it adds to the flavor. You know, that little, you know, that rich, loamy smell of cow manure. It just, it's such an enhancement.
Yeah.
If you don't eat your meat, you can't have any pudding! How can you have any pudding if you don't eat your meat?
Screw the pudding.
Don't eat your meat!
I mean, never mind.
Don't eat your meat! Don't eat your meat! Don't eat your meat! Don't eat your meat! Don't eat your meat!
Don't eat the meat! Some USDA inspectors say, however, that the cook-only practice, because see, once you test it, and once you find out that it's crawling with all of these little toxic, terminally sickening microbes are just crawling all over the meat. Once they find that out, it goes into a pile that's called cook only. And it gets cooked, and as long as, you know, the middle manager who's being pressed by the CEO, gotta get the sales up, son. Never mind that we cook it for 17 minutes. Cook this batch for 15 and get it out the damn door. We've got a profit report to issue tomorrow. You know how it works. Some USDA inspectors say the cook-only practice means that higher than appropriate levels of E. coli are tolerated in packing plants. Time out. I need to know what the appropriate level of poop-borne bacteria is in a meat packing plant. What's appropriate? Was it Upton Sinclair that wrote The Jungle? Wasn't that about the meat packing, you know, and, you know, there's two things in America that you don't want to see made, and that's law and hot dogs? No, they say that it means a higher than appropriate level of E. coli is tolerated in packing plants, which raises the chance that clean meat will become contaminated. They say the cook-only practice is part of the reason for this year's sudden rise in incidents of E. coli contamination. Well, howdy-do. Quote, all the product that is E. coli positive, they put a cooking-only tag on it, said one inspector, who, like other federal inspectors interviewed, asked to remain anonymous, please, for fear they would lose their jobs. The companies will test, and everything that's positive, they slap that label on. We've just covered it up. Now, to be fair, there's no evidence that the cook-only meat has made anybody sick. It just makes it more likely that meat that will be passed on raw to consumers has come into contact with E. coli. You know, because we tolerate it. Because, you know, there's a lobbyist somewhere on K Street, and he's got buddies in Congress, most of them Republicans, although not all. And he walks around, you know, well, hell, I see, Senator, that you're needing some money for your political action committee. My goodness gracious. Howdy-do, is that $50,000 I see laying there on the ground? Well, bless my soul, that's not mine. If I was you, Senator, I'd put that in my political action campaign money, the war chest. By the way, not that there's any connection between the two, but Senator, it's getting mighty hard on us here. It's getting mighty hard. Consumers out there are saying they don't want to eat meat that's been around poop. Now, how are we gonna provide all the meat that this country needs? How are we gonna provide meat to school children if we can't let poop around the meat, Senator? Senator, we have a poop problem. Tell your colleague there across the aisle, I think I see $100,000 laying down by his feet, too. Oh, goodness gracious, there's money all around here. Where's it coming from? What's that, Senator? What's that? You never heard of such a thing? You mean you've never heard of such a thing as actually making us meatpacking people keep the meat away from the poop? I agree. It's just crazy talk. The U.S. Department of Agriculture regularly and routinely conducts tests for E. coli in slaughtering plants, but only, and looking for a loophole, only on meat that packing companies have already deemed free of E. coli. Interesting. Look, we got us some meat here. Why don't you inspect that? We're sure it doesn't have any E. coli on it. Dang, it doesn't have any E. coli on it. See how good we are? USDA officials, on the other hand, do not track how much meat is put into cook-only categories. One inspector said the government keeps putting out that we've reduced E. coli by 50% and all of that, and we haven't done nothing. We've just covered it up. USDA, of course, the Bush administration, USDA, says, that ain't so. They said the Food Inspection Service of the USDA, quote, collects its own random samples without waiting for test results from the plant. And, of course, they also conducted, the Tribune did, the lobbyists in the USDA who are hand in glove probably came out of the business, because that's how it works when you get a Republican administration. You know, the Department of Labor gets staffed by union busters, that kind of thing. Meat found with E. coli, they said, isn't worth as much. And, you know, free market economics will protect us. The meat companies said they've taken significant steps to eliminate E. coli in meat during the slaughtering process. We give the cow a nice shower after it stood all the way up to its udders in poo-poo. That includes lactic acid washes of carcasses and steam treatments in which carcasses are heated to kill the bacteria. If raw ground beef has to go into a cook-only category, it loses value. That's Randall Huffman, Senior Vice President for Scientific Affairs at the American Meat Institute. Hey, who do you work for? American Meat Institute. Want some steak tartare? There's not a big market for that cook-only meat. This is market dynamics, you understand. But I wasn't kidding. Nope, not by the hair of my chinny chin chin. I wasn't kidding. A good bit of the cook-only beef products wind up in the National School Lunch Program administered by the USDA. That agency, last year, 2006, bought 2.8 million pounds of cook-only beef. 2.8 million. That's a 2, a comma, an 8, 2 zeros, a comma, and 3 more zeros. See, this stuff is a little hard for me, because I know how the greasy, thin, gray settlings between the ears of right-wingers that pass for brains, I know how they operate. They hate things like school lunch programs. They loathe them, they despise them, and they go home, and with one hand doing one thing and the other writing, they write little arguments for why the school lunch program has to go away.
And it makes them terribly, terribly excited when they think about that. And one way to make the school lunch program go away is to prove that it can't work. One way to prove that the school lunch program can't work is to take tainted meat, meat that has been exposed to feces, and feed it to my children. Ooh, Lordy. I'm glad I don't live in an era when teleportation is a possibility. I'm glad Scotty isn't in the room here. Bob, would you like me to fire up the transporter and bring you a USDA inspector? No, Scotty, no, I'd like for you not to do that, because I don't want to do violence! And it's not the inspectors, anyway. It's the appointees from the Bush administration. Eh, what's a little poop for a poor kid? Because, you know how these ultra-right-wing white supremacist the Bush administration people think anyway, don't you? You know who they think of when they think about poor children? They don't think about poor white children. No! You know who they think they're feeding the feces-encrusted meat to? And I do as well. But it's poor white children, poor African American children, poor Asian children, poor Middle Eastern children, poor American Indian children. Poor children is poor children, after all, you see. Because the defining characteristic is poor and not race. And not even poor children. I mean, if you go to the public school system and unless mommy or daddy are packing the lunch, you're getting the poop burger. God Almighty. Kind of took my breath away. The USDA said in a written statement that procurement of ground beef and certain other products for distribution through the National School Lunch Program is governed by additional quality requirements like mandatory microbiological testing. You know, that's the part I mentioned earlier about where they say, well, you know, the poop's in there, but it's dead poop. It's dead E. coli. Of course, Jeannie Sneed, a food service consultant, formerly at Iowa State University, also noted that most school lunch program managers don't know that the cooked beef that comes into school lunches could have come in from cattle contaminated with E. coli. Now, here she is, Ms. Sneed, a food service consultant formerly at Iowa State University. And, you know, I imagine you don't get to be a food service consultant at Iowa State University just by falling off the turnip truck. This is Iowa, after all. And she said, I did not know that it's a common practice. Most people are probably not aware that it occurs, but it probably does not create a great amount of concern because if meat is cooked at a little less than 155 degrees, the E. coli is killed. I don't care if the E. coli is killed. Can we get square on that? I don't care if the E. coli is killed. It's little bacterial E. coli corpses in the meat. The USDA did say that it does collect and sample some cooked, ready-to-eat products for E. coli 0157H7. Great, some, thank you, some. I hope when it gets to my kids or me, I hope that it's some of the some that you've tested. E. coli can be difficult to detect and prevent. The bacteria live in intestines of cattle, which tolerate it. It can contaminate meat during the slaughter process if fecal matter comes in Wow, how many paragraphs did it take them to get to the poopy? Like 20 paragraphs before they get to where the E. coli comes from. Thanks, Chicago Tribune. You buried the lead again. That can happen in several ways, such as when workers accidentally puncture the digestive tract during removal or when a cow's hide, which might carry fecal dust. Fecal dust is taken off. Here's a segment of the article called Befuddled Meat Industry. You're not befuddled. The American meat industry is bewildered by this year's increased findings of E. coli contamination. Theories about the cases range from dry conditions in cattle feedlots, where cattle stand in manure, to changes in feed caused by high corn prices. Oh, Jiminy Christmas. We're the common sense bunch, right? If you stand the cow in the manure, but I don't have to explain this to you. On the other hand, you have corporate America. Well, what do you mean? I mean, they're standing in the manure and they're getting manure on the meat? Is that what you're trying? Yes, that's what I'm trying to say. Congratulations. Here's your toaster. Move along. Jesus. Cargill, the Minneapolis-based grain and foods giant, has recalled nearly 2 million pounds of ground beef due to E. coli concerns this year. More than 3 million pounds of General Mills Totino's and Gino's pizzas have been recalled because it was poop-flavored pepperoni on the pizza. The inspectors, the anonymous inspectors who were interviewed for the story, said that the E. coli increase came as a result of the methods used to slaughter the cattle, as well as the practice of designating affected meat cook only. Because, you see, as long as it's allowed, that means they can go ahead and make a, what's the fun word? Yes, we worship the holy prophet, and that's P-R-O-F-I-T prophet and not P-R-O-P-H-E-T prophet. We worship in America the holy prophet, P-R-O-F-I-T. And the companies can, by virtue of this loophole, go ahead and use the loophole to make a profit from meat that should be incinerated. The American meat industry produced 26.3 billion pounds of beef in 2006. That was down from 33.7... I'm sorry, misreading. The 26.3 billion pounds of beef came from 33.7 million cattle. Now let that one wander around in your head too. And this ain't rawhide, you know, yeah, hit them up, get them out, move along. No! These are cattle standing in bovine concentration camps, barely able to move, force-fed foods that they are not meant to eat in the first place, which then means that they have to be constantly injected with antibiotics to keep them from getting sick and dying on the food that they're not supposed to be eating in the first place, which then gives them the trots, which they stand and, you know, while they're eating. Gary Mickelson, a spokesman for Tyson Foods, one of the nation's largest beef producers, you know, one of the ones who really, really hustles some of those 33.7 million cattle through the death process every year. Well, he said his company's developed a special testing program, Tyson Total N60, to detect E. coli. The program's so effective, Mickelson said, that other companies now use it. Tyson tests all raw beef components we know are destined for ground beef production. And that program provides a 95% or greater assurance of finding E. coli. Oh, great! So only 5% of the 33.7 million slaughtered cattle are infected. Cargill declined comment for the story. Of course, you know what the argument is. Well, you know, if we eliminate the cook-only category, that's going to drive the price of beef up. Fine. If it drives the price of beef up, maybe people will under... Nah. One other inspector said... The large meatpacking plant where he worked produced 500,000 pounds a week of E. coli-positive beef that was tagged cook-only.
It's a smokescreen, he said. The agency says, look at all this testing. The meat companies are still producing 500,000 pounds a week of E. coli product, and we're patting them on their back. Really? I'm convinced because I'm a horribly paranoid individual, desperately in need of medication, that there is a concerted effort to make me a vegan. And only because I am a hard-headed son of a gun who has a real passion for ribs and pulled pork barbecue pig meat, am I not one yet. Because I lose all sense at the first sign of hickory smoke. You know, if they could turn that into a perfume, it's like an aphrodisiac, hickory. So, you know, that's the beginning of the show for tonight. Lord, Lord, Lord. You tell me, am I overreacting? Is there something wrong with us who are who make every effort to remain informed and connected to our world? Is there something wrong with us for paying attention to this kind of stuff? Is there something wrong? Is it over angsted? Ooh, there's a hateful word. It's not even a word, I don't think. Is there too much angst involved in paying attention to this kind of stuff? What would you do? Some of you have kids, I know. How do you feel about putting them into the public school system and letting them eat school lunches, knowing that there is meat going into their little bellies that has had contact with cattle feces? And that the Bush administration says, what the hell, as long as you're cooking it, so what if it's dead? And it's still there, no worries. Like I've said before, this is all part of it. Oh, Bob, you know, it's so what? I mean, you know, don't you know that we need to impeach George Bush and end the war? It's all the same thing. The same government that brought you Katrina. The same government that brought you the California wildfires. The same government that brought you the Iraq War and is doing everything in its power to bring you the Iran War. The same government that brought you habeas corpus abuses. The same government that brought you warrantless wiretapping. The same government that brought you domestic spying. The same government, the same government, the same government that was sound asleep and allowed 9/11 to happen. Sits quietly by as contaminated meat is cooked and then hustled off to the lunch tray of the little ones you love so well. And we're supposed to just ignore it, or at best tolerate it, and shut up and keep moving, because these are not the droids we are looking for. Right?
Don't you get me! Don't you get me! If you don't you get me, you can't have any pudding! How can you have any pudding if you don't you get me?
Indeed, indeed. So we'll be back. Let me know your thoughts. 304-658-5453. 877-443-2366. Either way, get you right into the studio. This is America's listener-supported, independently operated, liberal voice. This is The Horn. I'm Bob Kincaid.
When I'm president, I'm going to say to members of Congress and members of my administration, including my cabinet, I'm glad that you have health care coverage and your family has health care coverage. But if you don't pass universal health care by July of 2009, in 6 months, I'm going to use my power as president to take your health care away from you. There's no excuse for politicians in Washington having health care when you don't have health care.
I'm John Edwards, and I approve this message.
We know you want to save big on your phone bill, and we know how you can.
That's right. We do.
We're saving more than 50% on our home phone bill since we switched to CityNet's digital phone plan.
Really? Over 50%?
CityNet's digital phone plan is only $24.95 a month.
Only $24.95?
You get unlimited local and long-distance calling.
Just $24.95.
And with CityNet's digital phone plan, you keep your current number. All you need is a high-speed internet connection. Get details at citynet.net.
$24.95.
And, oh, this is cool. With CityNet's digital plan, I can use my home phone anywhere in the world with high-speed internet. No extra cost.
There's 20, and there's 4, and there's 95.
Did I mention CityNet is a West Virginia-owned company?
Did I mention $24.95?
Save at least 50% on your residential phone. Get unlimited local and long distance and keep your same number, all for just $24.95 a month. Visit citynet.net today for more details. Some exclusions and restrictions may apply.
Here's the guy changing the way you hear music, Billy Shears.
Tune in to Night Sounds every Saturday night, 9 p.m. to midnight Eastern. You'll hear the latest in new music releases, special segments like One Hit Wonders, Under the Covers, and Night Sounds dedications with the sassy and classy Erica Richards. For requests and dedications, direct your email to nightsounds@billyshearsmusic.com. So tune in and stop by the chat room this Saturday night at 9 p.m. Eastern, right here on the Head On Radio Network, The Horn.
Hey. Thanks for lending an ear.
Here's a little test for you. Identify the following water-saving devices around your home. Using water wisely is important since our growing population puts pressure on this limited resource. Ready? That's water-saving device number 19, your outdoor faucet. Check faucets, sprinklers, and hoses for drips or leaks to save water and money. That's your toothbrush, water-saving device number 54. Turn the faucet off while you brush and save up to 25 gallons a month. It's water-saving device number 11, your water bill. If it's unusually high, you could have a leak. Learn to detect and repair leaks by contacting your water provider. Last clue? That's BeWaterSmart.net, a helpful website full of water-saving tips from the Water Conservation Coalition and your local water provider. There are a number of ways to save water, and they all start with you. Water, use it wisely.
Rockets, 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 rockets.
Okay, about 7 minutes before the hour, and I want to make those 7 minutes count to the best of our possible abilities. And we're joined by William calling from Hollywood. Hey, William, welcome to the program.
Hi, how are you doing?
I'm getting along, I guess. I'm a little nauseated about now.
Yeah, really. I was kind of confused about cook only. What does that mean exactly?
It means once they've discovered that it's contaminated, they then cook it and process it and send it out for people to eat, and they say that because it's been cooked, the E. coli is dead, and therefore it's safe.
Oh, so it's cooked before you get it.
Right.
So it's like the meat at these fast food places and such?
Well, no, not necessarily. Like, if you look in the freezer section and you see heat and serve hamburgers that have already been cooked.
Oh, I've never seen that. I don't.
Or, you know, canned hot dog chili, the meat that's in canned beef stew.
I gotcha. Okay.
So yum, yum.
Pardon?
I said yum, yum.
Yeah, I didn't even consider the stuff in the cans. I've kind of stayed away from the meat sections in grocery stores ever years ago when I saw the row of sheep's heads and then my first glimpse of, what is that called, head cheese?
Oh,
Oh, that just gives me the shivers at the mere mention of it.
Yeah. That is so vital. I can't imagine who came up with that idea. They must have been.
Oh, they were probably my Scottish ancestors, William.
You think?
You know, yeah, oh, yeah, because, you know, if it ain't moving, we'll eat it.
Yeah. Yeah, I stayed away from all that for years and years.
Well, you know, consider haggis. A blend of meat and barley and spices cooked inside a sheep's stomach. You know, I think I'd just go hungry.
I think I would, too. I mean, I know I would. I've gone to cereal and, you know, things like that. I just stay away from red meat altogether. I have for years because it's just...
Well, I think that's where I'm on the way to. And you know, it kind of bugs me because, you know, I'm not one of these people who believes that, you know, the world would be a better place if we just turned loose all the cattle, you know, just wander the range and be happy little beefs. That's not the way they've been bred. But
no.
On the other hand, this is, you know, this is not your grandfather's beefsteak.
No.
Here where we live, 50 years ago, my grandmother and grandfather raised 2 beefs a year and probably 3 pigs
mm-hmm.
for meat.
Right.
And they slaughtered them and hung them and took care of them and were very careful with them. And that's, you know, that was the meat they had to eat.
Right. I mean, you know, years ago, when I lived in Illinois and in the first period of time I lived in northern Florida, near St. Petersburg, there were cattle farms there. But they were maybe 25 or 30 cattle on quite a large area, you know, fenced in, but just grass, you know.
Right, which is what they're supposed to eat.
Right. It wasn't anything like what I imagine it today. And I saw years ago they had a documentary, To Love or to Kill.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you've saw that or not.
No, I don't think so, but
it was about the different cultures on how they treat, you know, what they deem as edible, what isn't, as far as animals go, you know, what maybe they are pets of someone else's food. But they showed some of the processing of the cattle and, you know, just that was a pretty disturbing film, a documentary. I think it was probably out maybe 6 or 7, maybe 10 years ago, I forget now.
And it hasn't gotten any better. That's the key. It's gotten worse.
But, I mean, these farms now, every time I think of a farm now or a cattle farm, I think of some sort of industrial plant, you know, where they're raised in cramped quarters and like you were describing.
Well, what happens, and it's documented pretty well in Michael Pollan's book, The Omnivore's Dilemma. The cattle are raised, you know, basically in fields for a certain amount of time, and then at a designated time they are packed up and shipped to one of these feedlots where they finish their lives. And they stand on concrete lots eating from huge industrial corn troughs. And that's all they do. And they, you know, where they eat. And then, you know, they're led into the slaughter area. They're killed, stripped, cut up, whatever. You know, all in the same circumstances. And you know, I'm no member of PETA or anything. I'm a meat eater, but I believe that there's got to be a better way. And what you've got here is a classic case of the meat industry, who is, you know, deeply in bed with, you know, a guy that they perceive to be a real live genuine shoot 'em up cowboy, you know, George Bush.
Right.
And they get their way.
Oh yeah, just like with everything else. That it would force to get their way.
It's all, you know, the name of the story was The Loophole. Everything right. With the Bush administration that relates to the safety of the American people has a loophole.
Right.
And
yeah, was,
go ahead, please.
No, I was just going to, you know, just a little bit off subject. I was looking at the photo you have on the site with the mountaintop removal.
Mm-hmm.
That looks pretty devastating.
It's actually worse than what you're looking at.
Really?
Yeah, because, you know, that was shot from, you know, 1,000 feet up in an airplane.
Uh-huh.
To get down at ground level, it's, you know, the dust, the smoke, the abject destruction, it'll never be, you know, can you look at that and think that that's ever going to be a mountain again?
No, I can't imagine how they could ever put it back. I mean, what did they do with all the trees and the grass and everything that was there?
Well, that got pushed over into the valley.
laying there in piles.
Yeah, and they'll pour, and they push a, what they call what's left over after they've taken all the coal. They've got a word for it. They call that overburden.
Overburden.
Yeah, and they take and they use something that's like a big modern steam shovel. It's called a drag line. It's about 8 stories tall. It uses something on the order of 80 gallons of high sulfur diesel fuel per hour. And they carve away the mountain with that thing, and then what's left after they've gotten the coal, they take these big D9 and D7 Caterpillar dozers, and they push it over the mountainside and bury the valley and the stream and the wildlife, and everything alive in the valley just gets buried and killed.
Inside the mountain where they strip the coal out of it.
Right.
And that's how they build up the base of the mountain. And then what's left after that, just what I'm looking at in this photo.
What that will look like after they have so-called reclaimed it, William, it'll be a big, barren place that grows nothing but scrub grass. Trees won't grow on it. Food won't grow on it. You can't drill it and put a well into it. There's nothing. It'll mostly just be a vile, muddy place with a lot of runoff. When it rains, nothing will catch or soak up the rain, and the rain will run off into the surrounding communities and cause devastating floods.
And along with it, bring all the garbage that they've stirred up into the water.
Precisely.
I mean, I was through the Appalachians a long time ago, a few times.
Mm-hmm.
But, I mean, I just remember it being mountains with trees and grass and, you know, this is unbelievable.
Stunningly beautiful, oh. Yes.
Yeah, it was. I saw some guy on television that he's, I don't know if he was a midget or dwarf or whatever, but he was a really small guy. And he was standing on the edge of his property where they haven't removed his mountaintop yet, looking down on all this, where they've been destroying it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, I saw that on television not too long ago, and that was pretty devastating.
If it was on CNN, I know who that was. That was our dear friend Larry Gibson.
Uh-huh.
And what you're looking at, if you let that photo you're looking at, William, that last little bit of green that sticks up out of all the devastation on the right-hand side of the photograph?
Right.
That's Larry Gibson's land.
So he gets to look at this wonderful view now.
Right.
Oh.
Once upon a time, he couldn't see out from the mountains up above him. Now the mountains are all leveled below him, and he looks down on it all. Yeah, it's heartrending. William, we've got to go to the news, but I'm sure glad you called in, and I enjoy talking to you. Anytime you feel moved, just pick up the phone and give us a shout, will you?
Very good, I will.
Take care now.
You too.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Coming up, I hope, our conversation with Kenny Perdue. First, the news. You're listening to America's Liberal Voice. You're listening to The Horn. And we will be right back. I'm Bob Kincaid.
I have a picture.
This is the Quality News Network. Defense Secretary Robert Gates warning Congress this morning that if they do not pass a war spending bill, the result could include massive layoffs at U.S. military bases funded by the Pentagon. Gates insists that the jobs of as many as 100,000 civil service workers could be at risk if representatives don't come up with legislation soon containing enough money to cover defense spending. House members passed a $50 billion spending plan last night tied to a U.S. troop withdrawal by the end of next year, but the bill may not pass the Senate, and even if it does, President Bush has promised a veto. Most congressional Democrats say they won't pass a funding measure unless it contains a timetable for bringing troops home within the next 12 months. The new Iraqi government must come up with a new power-sharing arrangement soon or face the consequences alone. U.S. military officials overseeing the war point to an existing window of opportunity during a current decrease in attacks in Iraq. The U.S. commander of daily operations says so far, Iraqi government leaders have failed to come together. The U.S. military says that the number of roadside bomb attacks decreased last month in Iraq. A U.S. general credits Iran's commitment to stop the flow of weapons into Iraq as one of the reasons for that drop. Elsewhere in the Middle East, Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas calling for the overthrow of the Hamas leaders in Gaza today. His comments preface next month's Middle Eastern Peace Summit to be held in Annapolis, Maryland. Former Pakistani Prime Minister Benazir Bhutto released from house arrest after several days. She'll participate in an upcoming rally against President Pervez Musharraf's emergency rule. Bhutto will be under heavy guard, but will be able to move around wherever she likes. That's according to Pakistani authorities. Super slugger Barry Bonds indicted by a federal grand jury on charges of perjury and obstruction of justice. That's according to an official from the U.S. Justice Department. On Capitol Hill, Republican Representative Dennis Hastert of Illinois announcing his resignation from public service today. The former Speaker of the House held the office longer than any representative in U.S. history. CNN and the Nevada Democratic Party hosting a TV debate tonight in Vegas for Democratic presidential candidates. You're listening to the Quality News Network. We'll take a look at science and business news next.
As the world moves to the Internet for marketing, promotion, sales, and communications, it is important to stake out your presence, your business, or yourself in an effective way. The people at Byte Technology know how to define your best self on the web so that people who know you and those who will want to can get a clear picture of who you are and what you have to offer. Byte Technology will design your website so that you will attract new customers and keep your current client base engaged and informed. As McLuhan said, the medium is the message. And never was that more true than in the new Internet commerce world. Whatever your business, selling products or services, to the general public or to a niche market, you need a presence that smart people, the people who make the best customers, can find quickly and understand immediately. Byte Technology will custom produce such a site for you. Byte Technology. See the difference at byte-technology.com or call 831-656-9178.
Scientists have discovered two more genetic links leading to juvenile diabetes. The incidence of the disease rising rapidly, fueled by the increase in youth obesity. In France, day three of chaos as unions continue a nationwide transport strike. Workers are protesting economic reform of the pension system. The strike is a crucial political test for President Nicolas Sarkozy. Europe's largest bank, HSBC Holdings, taking a $3.4 billion charge as a result of the U.S. mortgage crisis. The London-based institution warned the situation would worsen if America's housing market weakens any further. Vehicles made by Ford and Honda rated the safest in annual Highway Safety Agency tests. The number of new cars rated as tops in safety tripled compared to this time last year. Shares of PetSmart rose more than 6% after the company raised its annual earnings outlook, that even though the nation's largest specialty pet retailer posted a lower quarterly profit on sales of $1.12 billion. Light sweet crude oil trading at $93.43 a barrel, gold at $787.30 an ounce. At today's close of Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average down 121 points at 13,110. NASDAQ down nearly 26 points. S&P 500 down 19. More at our website, qualitynewsnetwork.com. I'm Barbara Lewis.
It's your second hour in the Liberal Sandbox, and you're head on with Bob Kincaid.
Yes, you are. You most assuredly are. This is Head On. I'm Bob Kincaid, Thursday night. And as promised in our first hour, we are joined on the phone now by the president of the West Virginia AFL-CIO, Ken Perdue. And I'm very, very glad to have Ken on the line because I want you to know more about this nurses' strike.
simply because it's not just a, this isn't just something that's happening to West Virginia. It's West Virginia and Kentucky, and what's more, it's, you know, coming to a community near you as the healthcare crisis in America worsens. Ken, welcome to the program. Thank you for taking time to talk to us.
Sure, Bob, thank you for the opportunity. I'm just glad to be able to talk about what's happening out there in the workplace.
Well, you know, nobody fights harder for working people than the AFL-CIO does, Ken. And the fact that you're out there standing up for these nurses, you know, it's the everyday kind of thing that the AFL-CIO does, and that maybe people don't know so much about. First of all, let's talk a little bit about this nurses strike and what you understand about it. Obviously, these nurses at Beckley, at Appalachian Regional Hospitals, they're not on strike because they feel like they're being underpaid. It's how they're being treated, isn't it?
Well, it's about overtime. They work overtime and then the company won't pay it. It's about shortage of staffing. And I think of when that hospital started, it wasn't started by the group that's in there now. It was started by the mine workers back years ago. It was about taking care of people. It was about providing prescriptions for the people, and it was about a community that needed one. And they're lowering the standards, and I hope the community hears this, they're lowering the standards for the health care in the Beckley and Hinton area.
And, you know, that these hospitals were originally started by the UMWA and John L. Lewis, weren't they? I mean, weren't they originally called miners' hospitals?
Yes, they were.
And so we're the Appalachian Regional Hospital people are taking that legacy and basically defaming it, if you will. You say these nurses are forced to work overtime and then they're not paid for it. How in heaven's name can the hospital get away with that, Ken?
Well, they're getting away because they're ignoring what the court's saying, what the Department of Labor has said. They have chosen to, what I would consider, break the law. And in order to break the law, these nurses have said enough is enough, and you're not treating us that way because we are the caretakers for the patients in the hospitals. And the people that are paying for it now, you know, I applaud the nurses for walking out because they are taking the stand on health care in Beckley and Hinton, West Virginia. They are doing it as a sacrifice to themselves. And I want the community to know they're sacrificing their family, their pay, their income, the food on their table, to take a stand to protect the employees that are in that hospital now that didn't come out. I mean, so these are other people that are in there. But it's about the community. It's about these patients in there that need better care. The patients deserve a better care, and the hospital has chosen not to give them a better care. So these nurses are in a position. And I just applaud them 110% on what they're doing.
It is not easy to be in a strike situation, Ken. This is probably the single biggest pro-labor audience as far as radio is concerned that there is, and they're very sympathetic to labor issues. Many of them probably have never had to be in a strike situation, though. Could you sort of paint a picture, Ken, of what that is like?
Well, I've walked many a picket line with many of them, and I've been in a situations where I've watched these people take a stand, stay there all night. People come in the next day, you know, and there's typically strike funds set up to help these people, but it's not enough to make up for wages for they lost. It's not enough to make for income, and it's definitely not enough to take care of a family. It's like working well below minimum wage. So, you know, they stand out there in the cold. They stand out in the snow, which it's hitting West Virginia now. They stand out in the rain, and they have chosen, and I know they've done this, and I'm proud of them. They have chosen to be the ones that are going to be the standard bearers for health care in West Virginia. They said enough is enough, and they're going to protect their patients, even if they go stand out in this cold weather for what now is 6 or 7 weeks to protect these patients. And I hope the patients realize that they're out there for them. It's not about a personal agenda. It's for them. It's about staffing, and it's about overtime. Yes, it is a little bit of wages, but it's about staffing. And if you're not staffing, you're not taking care of your patients.
Well, you can't expect to have adequate patient care with people who are exhausted on a day-to-day basis, Ken. This is a question of how we treat working people in this country, and it's an extension of the things that happen to unrepresented workers and workers who are over a barrel all over this country. We've seen other nurses' strikes out in Las Vegas, places like that. How does the AFL-CIO work to make this strike process more tolerable for these nurses?
Well, it is the one thing about the AFL-CIO, it is one big family. That's not saying we don't have a few feuds within the family. That's known. But this family, when one person in the family is in trouble, the others come to perform. And I think that rally exemplified a little bit of that. The National AFL-CIO, Wales Oil Organization, many other locals within West Virginia took money to these striking nurses, took food to these striking nurses. And I know local people are providing not only human support to stand on a picket line with them, but the community itself is beginning to step up. If you stand on a picket line and you listen to the horns as people go by, and you see the goon guards stand over there and they wonder what's going to happen, because this is when the community support is there for somebody that they believe is doing right. I think that these people that are the goon guards watching, they need to be watchful of those people. Then also the hospital people need to be watchful. They need to understand that the community supports these strikers.
How about local government support? We've heard a little bit about it in the past. In Beckley and Hinton, what about local government getting behind the nurses?
Well, I think that, to my understanding, the local government is not as strong in support of these yet. And I'm not speaking for all of them, but it is our objective to ensure that those legislators are understanding what's going on. It could very well be them out there, or one of the family members be out there, and that the local city. Elected officials or county elected officials understand what this means. The ones that support it, I applaud them. The ones that aren't there, they need to understand what they're fighting for. So it is part of our task to help these nurses to ensure that the legislators, as well as all the elected officials, are supportive. And I might add to that, Bob, that as we go through this and we support these nurses, the governor has taken a position and has a person in there to help negotiate the way through this, and that's something that has not happened in the past. That is a governor that's caring for not only the strikers, but he knows that these patients in there, they need to care, and they need the best, most qualified nurse that area provides. They need them in the hospital, and it is not the what they were calling the replacement workers that are in there now. I call them scabs,
yep,
because they chose to lower the standards for their occupation by going in there and walking across that picket line.
Well, have you talked to any of these nurses, Ken?
The ones that are on strike?
Yes.
Yes, I talked to them Saturday when we had that rally, and they're fired up and ready to stay out.
Well, that was my next question, because this isn't the kind of industry where you frequently see actions like this. But you say that they're dedicated, they're committed to their cause, and they're willing to wait. What's the saying? One day longer than the company. Is that the case?
Oh, yeah, as you say, it is. It's never give up, and it's one day longer than the company. I believe that there's there before Saturday. There may have been a little weakness in there, but they're starting to see more and more support from not only the community but their union brothers and sisters. When it brings in, they're bringing money and food to them, as well as walking a picket line with them. I want to remind people that when this hospital was started, it was a mine worker hospital. There are hundreds and hundreds and probably thousands of mine workers within that listening audience there that have either worked in the mines or working currently in the mines, that are retired from the mines, that have been through that hospital. They need to step up and get out there and help support those brothers and sisters on the picket line. And our brothers and sisters need to understand that there's going to be people there for them. So I think that there was some excitement Saturday. I think the excitement's going to lead into a better feeling with them. And to the labor community, you need to get out there to support them. They need your help badly.
Well, what about folks who may not necessarily be a member of a union or... have some sort of an organization. Are there things that individuals can do to help these nurses?
Any individual that wants to, that believes that what's going on, that they need better care at their hospital, can go and walk a picket line with them. They can put money into the coffers for them. They can bring food over to them. And they can call the elected officials and tell them, we need to get this over with. We need to get rid of this. In this case, they applaud the governor for doing it. The community itself can be the strongest back support, the backbone of that strike that the hospital has ever seen. When that community gets behind them, that hospital needs to be a little bit concerned, because that community is the one that supports that hospital now that the hospital is not supporting the community.
Well, tell me, after a strike like this has gone on, and you know, there are bad feelings and things like that, how hard is it to go back into a work environment, Ken?
Well, you know, in a lot of the big facilities, maybe in the steel or chemical plants, that may be kind of hard to go back in when you got some bad feelings. But I'm going to say, in this situation here, these nurses, and they were saying it on Saturday when they were speaking to us, they want to be in there caring for their patients. They want to be able to provide the care. And these are qualified. These aren't replacement workers they're after. These are qualified nurses that need to be in it. They want to be in it. And I would say this, probably the day this strike is over, when it's one day longer, that we survive, that we win, that they're going to go in, they're going to hold their heads high, they're going to take care of the patients that need the care.
Well, that I know some of the nurses who are on the picket line, and you know, they're strictly professional people, and would rather, I think it's safe to say, isn't it, Ken, they would rather right now be in there caring for their patients, because it is about patient care. But the company really did draw a line in the sand on this one, didn't they?
Yes, they did. And I say yes, the nurses that are out there in the snow and the mud, in the rain and the cold, they know these people. You know, Beckley and Hinton area, they're not big communities. They're close-knit communities, and a lot of people know each other. They walk through the town, they know each other. They see them in the mall, and they go to football games, and they see them. So they know the people that are in there that need the care. The nurses that they have in there now, if you call them nurses, and I'm probably saying I put them at the higher standard of what they deserve. People, I would ask this: who are they? Where do they come from? Do they really care about the patients that are in there now? I would say that they don't.
I would say that you're probably right. It's even questionable as to whether they're members of the community, isn't it?
I would say they're probably not. I think they're from all over the place.
Well, I remember there was a strike problem with the other workers inside there. A few months back, maybe a year ago, and the hospital did the same thing, and really, really low quality, questionable skills people brought in for matters that deal with human lives, Ken, and that's the saddest thing out of all of this. It's not there are wage issues, there are quality of care issues, and at the same time, the company is willing, the company's gambling with human lives on this, aren't they?
They do that. It's unbelievable that they would even have these nurses out there not having much of a discussion with them, because it is. Their responsibility is to be a good neighbor to the community, and they're not doing that. Now, they are, as you said exactly right, they are gambling with the life of a mother, brother, sister, aunt, or uncle, or maybe even a new child of somebody who could be on that picket line, could be a friend, could be a neighbor. They're gambling with their lives. And you said it well.
Well, I tell you what, I'm awfully proud to know what you guys did last weekend with the food drive, with the money drive, going and standing up with those nurses in Beckley, in Hinton. What comes in the future?
More of the same. I would hope it's not too much more in the future. There'd be more of the same. And I'll add, as we have people from all over the state come in and walk to pick a line and help with the food and help prepare it, bag it, give it to, bring money, speak to the nurses. We had nurses that flew in and walked a pick line with them from California. You had Kentucky nurses that came in. New York nurses came in. This could very well be turned into an activity that ARH is not ready for. since because there's a lot of nurses in this country, and if they get banded together, you can look back in this situation here in West Virginia, Kentucky, and this situation ARH is creating, it could put a black eye on ARH because they chose not to take care of the community and really get an excitement going on in this nursing industry to say, well, they're sick and tired of it, and they're not going to take it anymore.
Ken, I know that
we're there to back them.
I know that the AFL-CIO is a leader in the fight for health care for all Americans. Is the kind of stuff that we're seeing with this ARH strike, is it something that you think is going to expand in America if we don't do something about our health care crisis?
Sadly to say, you could very well be right. If we're not, if people like ARH is not willing to step up to the table and say, let's sit down and talk about this health care. Why is it costing so much? And why is maybe the care not affordable for somebody? Why is it not available? Why is the cost so high? And why is the copay so high? If they're not willing to step up, maybe we ought to get out of the way and let somebody else take care of that hospital, sell it to somebody that's going to get or manage it right. But I think the main objective here is what we're trying to do as well as the nurses. And I'd say it's a lot of the hospital community in the state, because I'm familiar with a lot of the different people that are either CEOs or over the hospital associations. They're good people. They want to make sure these hospitals are run right. They want to make sure these hospitals take care of people. I hope, and I believe this, but I'm hoping also, too, that this is just a slight bump in the road in what they're trying to do. The bigger picture is, how do we address the health care issue? ARH needs to step up. First thing is to get these people back in and get taken care of. And then maybe they could be a leader in making sure that West Virginia, and I think we could be a leader in this, that we are willing to step up and say, let's figure out why our health care costs are so high. I think we ought to do that. And I would challenge them to do that.
Well, I would join you in that, Ken. I really appreciate your time this evening. Is there anything else that you'd like to add? Is there anything that we haven't touched on? If so, you know, I want you to have an opportunity to say anything else that we haven't gotten to.
Well, let me say this to the nurses that are on strike, and I hope they're listening this evening. You have the support of the whole labor movement in the state of West Virginia. We are there to fight for you. We will fight in the halls of legislature. We will bring money to you. We'll bring food. We'll walk the picket line with you. You've got friends out there that want you. And to the community, needs to take a hard look at this. It's a difference of nurses that want to take care of patients, or it's a difference of corporate greed. And I look at ARH being the corporate greed, and that's what's driving the cost of everything so much, so high, that corporate greed. We will stop the corporate greed to the greed that ARH is having. It won it their way now.
Well, fight on, my friend. Fight on, and
want to fight, buddy.
And we talk about this strike, and we encourage people to lend support in whatever manner that they can. And I'm just proud to know that the labor movement in West Virginia is standing behind these nurses, because we are all in this together, aren't we?
Yes, we are. We're alive and well, and we're going to make a difference.
All right. Ken Perdue, thank you very kindly, and give our best, please, to everyone down there at West Virginia AFL-CIO headquarters. We really appreciate you taking time to be with us.
Appreciate you.
Bye now.
Bye.
West Virginia AFL-CIO President Ken Perdue. This strike in Beckley, in Hinton, and it also crosses over, crosses state lines into Kentucky, is truly shaking these fairly small communities. And they are close-knit, as Ken said. And there's a big difference between what's happening in Kentucky and what's happening in West Virginia. In Kentucky, local governments have come out four square in favor of the nurses. We're not having quite that kind of success in Beckley, where the mayor of Beckley made a public statement that he is four square behind the hospital company. against the nurses. You know, we're about to enter a political season, and we will hear things like, I believe in the working man, and I stand up for the working man, and I'm the working man's candidate. Well, if a politician has ever said that, and then cannot bring himself or herself to stand behind working people when the working people whose vote he or she solicited in the last election need him, well, doesn't that put the lie to "I'm behind the working man"? Doesn't it give at least the whiff of disingenuousness to a person who would say something like that? Certainly seems to me that it does. So, if you would like to, you can look up Appalachian Regional Hospitals on the internet. You can send an email to their management. You can find the phone number. You can call and tell them to put their patients first and to stop gambling with the lives of the most fragile among us and put these qualified, dedicated servants of humanity itself back where they so badly want to be, serving the people who need them. We'll take a quick break and we'll come back. Your phone calls are always welcome, 877-443-2366, 304-658-5453. Either one rings right here to the studio. You're listening to America's Liberal Voice. You're listening to The Horn. I'm Bob Kincaid.
Listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. I'm Doug Cunningham. Hundreds of workers led by the AFL-CIO rallied in Washington, D.C. at the National Labor Relations Board on Thursday. They were protesting the board's recent anti-worker decisions. Fred Ascarati, director of Voice at Work, was one of the protesters.
There are a bunch of decisions that make it harder for workers to organize, the majority sign-out decisions that take away the workers' rights, were illegally fired, to back pay, that make our bad labor laws even worse.
Day 12 of the Hollywood writer's strike continues to impact television programs, and as a result, new media is playing a major role in getting the message out from writers. Jesse Russell reports.
From blogs to YouTube, striking television writers are showing the power of new media in a big way. It shouldn't be a surprise, as new media is at the core of the negotiation breakdown with Hollywood producers. The writers want compensation for when their material appears on the internet or other new technologies. The Writers Guild of America has been posting daily videos that detail the issues, capture life on the strike lines, and even feature cameos from the actors who are dependent on scripts for their shows and movies. One video captures members of the Screen Actors Guild joining a picket at Universal Studios. Zach Braff is an actor on Scrubs and also a WGA member.
I think the studios need to learn to share all that secret internet money that they know they're making.
Sarah Silverman is an actor and writer for The Sarah Silverman Show.
All the writers want is a small percentage of the money that the producers are making on the things that they're writing. They're getting zero.
Nia Vardalos is a writer and actor.
Here today, striking for the generation of writers behind me in the same way that writers before me struck for me and got me health care.
Helene Bonneau, the French Labor Federation CGT, says the French transport strike is a defense not only of pensions, but the overall social contract French workers have won through decades of struggle. Bonneau says the right-wing Sarkozy government is not unlike Ronald Reagan in its attack on workers and their unions.
Government wanted a clash in order to get rid of the trade union movement. So we had to avoid a clash which would be destructive for the trade union movement. And at the same time, we want to achieve something in terms of pension for all the workers concerned.
The Socialist Party in France supports the strike. Bonneau says negotiations are underway on the reforms Sarkozy is demanding, but she says Sarkozy is trying to dictate the framework while threatening to impose changes that would force public workers to work more years before qualifying for their full pensions. Here's Jesse Russell with today's economic report.
You may be paying even more at the pump than you previously thought. According to CNN, the U.S. military uses 340,000 barrels of oil per day, and that means every time a barrel jumps by $10, the pain is felt by taxpayers, who will see an additional $1.3 billion a year. The Pentagon deals out nearly $20 billion for that oil, with the Air Force the biggest user, at $8 billion per year. CNN reports 14 million less barrels were used in 2005, but they paid $3 billion more.
Doug Cunningham, Workers Independent News.
All right then, 25 minutes before the hour, halfway through tonight's Thursday night edition of Head On. And like I said, you know, this is a great thing for me because for 3 hours I really can put it away, and thanks to you guys, I've been able to. So my appreciation to you, you know, send me a bill or something because this is better than any shrink I could ever have. Wayne is on the line with us. Hey, Wayne, welcome to the program. Glad you could call in, especially after Ken was on the line.
Well, yeah, I wish I'd heard the whole thing, but I only heard the last 5 minutes or so, something like that. But
well, you stay pretty busy, so that's understandable.
Well, I was out on the picket line with the nurses. It's cold out there.
I'll bet it is.
It is cold out. Well, you know, I don't know. Did it snow at your house?
Yeah, it spit some snow today, but not as much as I think it did to you guys.
Yeah, we got a little more than that. I don't know. They're talking 1-2 inches or something like that.
Oh, geez, you're kidding.
Oh, yeah. But, you know, what are you going to do?
Well, you know, it's not like you can fold up the strike and go away because you get a few snowflakes in the air.
No, you can't. No, you can't. And I'll tell you, this thing is, and, you know, I don't, like I say, I wish I would have heard all of Kenny's interview and stuff, but this thing is turning into... Well, there, you know, Kenny alluded to it. I mean, there are nurses that have been here from all over the country. There are nursing associations that are sending money and support. Different locals are, adopting other locals. You know, one of the locals in Beckley or in Hinton, people are coming in, a husband and wife who are both registered nurses from, I believe, Illinois, and their two children are coming in, and people from all over the country are coming in so that the nurses here can go home and have Thanksgiving dinner with their family. They're going to stand the picket line on Thanksgiving Day.
God bless them.
Yes. I mean, it's, well, you know, in many ways, ARHO's awakened a sleeping giant. I mean, these... And I got to say women because the majority of them are women, you know. I mean, I don't know how many, I don't know what the ratio is, maybe 6-7% of the nurses are male, but these women are strong. I mean, they're intelligent, they're strong, and they're not giving up. They're not giving up. They got, you know, they set up Christmas trees already at their picket lines. You know, down in Hinton, the railroad workers came down there and built these women a wooden building, has French doors. A landscape guy came and put bushes and stuff around.
They're decorating.
Yeah. I mean, it's incredible, you know. And they're fighting for what they believe in, and they're going to win. I'm telling you, they are going to win. You know, they're down at negotiations this week. There was a representative from the governor's office in West Virginia and the new governor-elect from Kentucky, who the lieutenant governor that just won is a surgeon who refused to cross their picket line.
I'll be darned.
Yes. And then you know about the Letcher County.
Yeah.
Okay, well, Pike County has joined in, cutting off another $2 million to ARH. And, you know, I mean, it's these people never thought that these nurses would last. I mean, this is the seventh week.
Right.
Seventh week. And they're out there, and I'm telling you, buddy, they're strong. They're strong. They've got, it has changed, you know, like ARH. I mean, these people are evil. Did Kenny say anything about the SDA? I use organizer's car getting burned?
No. Wait. You can't just say something like that.
Well,
right?
I'm going to explain it.
Okay.
I've been, you know.
All right.
I'm nervous. They're, you know, like in the beginning, when the pickets first started and something, they had these security guards over there, and, you know, you'd look over there, and here's a bunch of old guys, overweight, drinking coffee and stuff, and, you know, if you went into the local McDonald's at 6 o'clock in the morning, here would be these five guys sitting there drinking coffee, reading the paper, and talking because they don't have anything to do. Then the next day, they're security guards, you know. I mean, they were...
here's your bullet, put it in your shirt.
Yeah,
I mean,
they're friends. I mean, they were friends. You know, they didn't... you know, they were just trying to make a little extra money. Now... I mean, the security guard, they've got some security guards over there now on the other side of the road. I mean, I don't know if these guys are from Blackwater or what, but they stand there constantly all day filming. They film me all day. And they used to be, you know, like they'd stand there and talk to each other. Now, they got a couple of guys over there, and all they do is stare at that crowd. Now, you're familiar with that area in Beckley.
Sure.
You stood on that picket line with me a few years ago.
That's right.
And a person from SEIU and a woman from the United American Nurses decided to walk up to the, what is it, Stop and Go, or, you know, the little convenience store a quarter mile up the road.
Sure, yeah.
So they're walking up there. Of course, they're on the picket side of the road. You know, the other side of the road from the hospital. And they walk up a pretty good ways. The guards are following them. And finally, the guard said to him, yelled at him, said, where are you going? And, you know, what do you mean where we're going? We're going for a walk. Well,
business is it of his?
Exactly. So they went up to the store and they came back. Well, you know, they talked for a few minutes while the guy from SEIU is leaving. Well, his car was parked in the back of the pharmacy that, you know, that doctor supports the nurses and has let them use their parking lot for all the rallies and all this stuff. Well, it's been known that these guards will go around behind the pharmacy in the woods and stuff. Anyway, the guy left the pharmacy and drove up and took a left, you know, at that road that goes to Lowe's?
Yeah.
McCullough Drive or something.
Right.
Well, he has a flat tire, amazingly enough. So he pulls over to the side of the road, walks back to the picket line, see if he could find somebody with a jack or whatever. They walk back. His car is on fire. Somebody got in his car, stuffed newspapers and brush and stuff under the dash, and set it on fire. Now, isn't that amazing?
What a coincidence.
What a coincidence. Of course, the mayor's office doesn't know anything about it.
No, no. Well, I mean, no, of course not.
You know, there was some little blurb in the paper about a strange vehicle fire. Of course, it never mentioned nurses, never mentioned the strike, never mentioned, you know, anything. But, so then the next day, nurses on the picket line are looking straight across at these two guys, and they are singing them Christmas carols.
Oh my God! When people show up with cameras, my first impulse is video the people taking the video.
Oh, we do that. We do that. Now we got people out there with cameras and stuff. You know, I don't know what they're. Yeah, well, it's ridiculous. It's ridiculous.
I got to get over that way. I'm pretty handy with a video camera, and not a bad shot with a still camera either. This sounds a little bit ugly, Wayne.
It is ugly, and it could get more ugly. You know, we've been to city council meetings, we've been to county commission meetings, we've been to Democratic Executive Board Committee meetings. We got nurses that have been down to the governor's office. Nurses that have gone to Ray Hall's office, and we're going to win this thing. I'm telling you, these people are going to win this thing, and it's going to be a great day for the whole American labor movement that these people stood up to this. They're tyrants.
Yeah, they are. It's dictatorial conduct.
That's exactly what it is.
Kenny Perdue mentioned that the governor's office is involved now. You know anything about that?
Yeah, you know Stan Hostler?
Sure.
Okay, Stan came into Steve White's office, my boss, and said, you know, what's the story on these nurses? What's the story on the nurses' strike? And, you know, Steve said, well, we got to call Wayne. So Stan calls me, you know, what's going on? I told him. I put him in contact with the head negotiator for Kentucky Nurses Association, Pat Tanner, who is, you know, handling West Virginia and Kentucky. She's the chief negotiator.
Right.
And I said, you know, Stan, she could tell you everything. You know, that's who to talk to. So he called me yesterday morning, or yesterday afternoon, I guess, and, it was Tuesday. And he said he had talked. I said, you know, what's your role now? You know, Stan has been many things. I mean, you know, he's been a labor lawyer for 100 years, and, you know, he's a multimillionaire, and he owns railroads. And,
sure.
But he's also he's a very good guy. Yeah, he's on our side, you know. So, he called me Tuesday afternoon and told me that he was flying down in the governor's jet Wednesday morning to be at the negotiations. Now, they just observe, okay, you know, and they're doing fact finding. And the governor insists he won't get involved until both sides ask him seriously to get involved. But and then the governor-elect from Kentucky sent a representative also. So
one of the things that's been on my mind about all this, Wayne, and correct me if I'm wrong, but I remember a few years ago during a legislative session, a bill got passed and was signed into law that forbade hospitals from compelling nurses to work mandatory overtime. Am I remembering that wrong?
But not if you belong to a union, Bob.
Ah, that was the wrinkle.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, somehow that got... Those were for unrepresented nurses, I guess.
Who, if being unrepresented, dared to say, no, I won't work the mandatory overtime.
We'll fire your butt anyway.
Right, yeah, yeah, you just got fired.
That's exactly right.
Okay, okay.
But
union nurses were explicitly exempted from that statute.
Yes.
Under the theory...
I can't tell you the exact wording or whatever.
No, but probably under the theory that their collective bargaining agreement would address the issue anyway.
Protect them, yes. And in most cases, you know, when you're dealing with reasonable people, you can get those protections. They are no longer dealing with reasonable people. You know, it's just that simple. So, you know, the fight continues. You know, they're down there talking. Darlene called me last night. I expect a call from her before too long. They're going to meet again tomorrow. And, you know, my whole deal with this thing, and if I was in on negotiations, which, of course, I'm not, but, I mean, I would simply tell these people, and, you know, I told you in the beginning, when they went into this negotiations, they were handed a 75-page document that completely rewrote every article in their contract, every article. And Article 1 of their constitution was established when the United Mine Workers sold those hospitals. Remember, those were financed, paid for, and operated by the United Mine Workers of America. And when they sold them to ARH, Article 1 was the secession clause. And the second paragraph of that clause says ARH cannot sell those hospitals to anyone without, unless they find a buyer that is willing to accept the union as the bargaining unit for the workers. That's been in effect since they sold them in the 50s, I guess it was. I don't know. And that is gone. They took that out. And, you know, if I was at the negotiating table, I mean, when they called me in there, I'd just simply tell them, you know, we're not going to waste any time or our people's money by coming down here and staying in hotels and stuff until you, the first thing you have to do is reestablish that successor clause. That has to be put back, and you have to agree with that.
Well, that smells like nothing but a blatant attempt at union busting. I mean, wouldn't that be the first step at busting the union?
That's exactly what they're doing, and that's why, you know, I've mentioned this group Yesen and Associates. I don't know if Kenny mentioned them.
No,
but anybody that's listening, you just Google Yessin, and you will come up with Yesen and Associates. And you'll see what their business is, and their business is union busting. They brag about a 96% success rate in ridding corporations of union. They're under federal indictment in New York for violating NLRB election laws. These are evil people. And Jerry Haynes and company has, including the mayor of Beckley, have hired them to rid their corporation of unions. That's what's going on.
So what do these people do? I mean, when they come in this Yesen outfit, how do they function?
They come into the hospital. They talk to all the nurses. They explain to them how they could withdraw from the union. They have captive audience meetings. They're political education meetings. Not anti-union, they're political education meetings.
Wait, so you mean they can haul you in and you can't walk out?
You're getting paid. You're required to be there.
That, I'm sorry, even if you're getting paid, that sounds a little like kidnapping.
Well, that's exactly what it is. Now, there's, I've talked to several nurses that have been in there. When I talked to, at these political education classes, and one nurse has never went. She said, every time they tell me I have to go, I just say, oh, who's going to take care of the patients? And she doesn't go. We have a law, you know, did Kenny talk about the Employees Freedom Bill?
No.
That we're trying to get through?
No.
In the state legislature outlaws that. It outlaws captive audience meetings for political, religious, anti-union, you know, views that you can't, that, you know, if an employee says, I don't want to go with that, you can, or go to that, you cannot retaliate against it. We've got a lot of signs. Mike Green signed it, believe it or not.
No kidding.
Yeah, at the last rally. Of course, Mel Kessler has.
Well, I knew Mel would probably be the first signature on the thing as far as legislation.
Yeah, well.
Mel's going to do the right thing.
Yes, he is. Yes, he is. Mel's a good man.
Yeah, he is.
We don't always agree on everything, but Mel's on our side. You can count on him. So. It's, you know.
Well, you know, this is it's a particularly hard time to be involved in something like this, Wayne, because the holidays are upon us. Thanksgiving is tough. Christmas and these are, and you know, Kenny did note that, you know, these people are well paid folks having to get by on something less than minimum wage strike funds. I mean, it takes a lot of guts and a lot of courage to stand up under these circumstances.
It's way less than minimum wage, believe me.
Oh yeah,
way less.
And to be facing the Christmas season like that is got to be, God, it's got to be tough.
It is tough. Man. It's very tough, you know, but these are very tough people. They're standing up for what's right.
And see, I think maybe that's what the hospital underestimated. They think, oh, you know, oh, they're nurses. You know, they're women. These women deal with the hardest part of human existence. And as a consequence of that, they are probably pretty well situated to be able to deal with something like this. You see what I'm saying?
Oh, I know exactly what. Listen, I was explaining that to one of the nurses the other day. I thought I was going to get punched. I said, listen, they never counted on you standing out here for 7 weeks. Well, I mean, we could. I said, yeah, but you don't. I said, you don't understand. I said, you're just frail little girls. You couldn't do it. Well, man, she jumped up out of
the I was going to say, how quick did you have to get
I'm
out of the way of that?
You that? I'm telling you what they think.
Yeah.
Jesus.
Well, what I mean, is there a law enforcement presence out there on the line or anything, Wayne?
Not enough, but we've notified the mayor that we want more police protection. I mean, since you hired some Blackwater guys over across the street and stuff, you're.
And the mayor sits on the board of the hospital, right?
He sits on the board of trustees. There's did I tell you about Colin O'Brien's show and me and him being on it?
Oh, you mean Lion O'Brien in the morning?
Yeah.
I don't want anybody making a mistake of thinking we're talking about Dr. Bill.
Not Dr. Bill. No. Anyway, once a month the mayor comes on for 2 hours.
Yeah.
Then, I don't know, I was somewhere and I'm driving into work and, he said something. Coming up to Mayor Beckley, and I said, oops. Gotta go. Gotta get to a phone.
Quick, to the bat phone.
I got the whole thing on tape. It's, the mayor doesn't like me, Bob. I don't know.
Really? You? Sweet little you?
Yeah, he doesn't like me. I ended our conversation with, Mayor, your position is not defensible. Well, I don't think yours is either.
Nah.
Yeah, okay, whatever. as long as you've been in office, you should have been able to come up with something better.
Yeah, that's the best you got.
Yeah. But, what are you going to do, man? We're fighting. And I'm telling you, we're going to win. We're going to win.
I have no doubt of it.
And my ultimate goal, this, you have to understand what, I mean, and I wished I had the figures. This Yesen and Associates, I mean, these people operate internationally. They do not come cheap. Okay? Then you've got more security guards that they're paying at that hospital than you've ever seen. There are security guards there's a security guard at every nurse's station. There are security guards that roam the halls. There are security guards outside. They have all these, what do they call them? Agency nurses.
Oh, scabs.
Scabs, yes. Scabs. And, you know, there's probably twice as many nurses as there, you know, there now than there ever have been. And it's costing these people millions and millions and millions of dollars. They're bleeding. You know, they're bleeding.
Yeah, but they're penny wise and pound foolish, Wayne. I mean, the money that they've spent on their advertising blitz, the money that they've spent on this Yesen and Associates, the money, the money, because they're having to pay the scabs higher than they pay the regular nurses. You know that.
They're paying them at least double, in some cases more than that.
You know, there must be something in the background there that is well worth all this money. You know what
getting
I mean?
Union.
Well,
getting rid of the union.
And you know that successor clause. That means that if they want to get rid of that, that means they're trying to hustle the hospital corporation off to somebody too, doesn't it?
That's exactly right. Or some of its units. You remember, you know, there are 7 hospitals in Kentucky and there's 2 in West Virginia. You know, maybe they, you know, would really like to dump the 2 in West Virginia. And, you know, if you're selling this thing and it doesn't have a union succession clause, it becomes a more attractive product.
Because then you can force
the rest of the corporate pigs.
Jesus.
And that's what we're dealing with.
Oh, yeah, we're dealing with slime. We're dealing with scum.
I mean, you know, these are the people you remember. I mean, that's where you got fired. And
it's right there on the hard drive between my ears. I remember it well.
And then this guy Jerry Haynes took over and decided he's not going to honor their contract and pay them 40 hours for 36 that's been in the contract forever, and stop paying them. And then the nurses threatened a job action, and ARH came back and said, well, let's go to binding arbitration. Whatever they say, we'll agree to. Okay, the nurses agreed. The arbitrator came back 6 months later and said, told ARH, you're wrong. We're siding with the nurses. You owe them all this money for plus 5%. And ARH and Jerry Haynes, being the honorable human beings that they are, said, screw you. We're going to court.
And appealed it to the circuit or the district court. And it's still sitting in the circuit court, isn't it?
In Cincinnati.
Yeah, where they're going to lose again.
Yeah, and then the next stage is the Supreme Court. And they, you know, they lost in 4 courts in Kentucky. And so they ended up having to pay back the nurses 6 months or 7 months, which was $4,000 or $5,000 a nurse. Well, now they owe all the nurses $4,000 or $5,000 or $6,000 again. And it's hung up in Cincinnati. And part of their ploy is, which doesn't have anything to do with the negotiations, they're telling the nurses, we'll give you $1,000 check if you'll just
shut up and go away.
Yeah, make that go away. And then, you know, and they're using, they had to put $3 million in a contingency fund. You know, the courts made them do that. So if they could buy off all these nurses for $1,000 a piece, then they could use the other $4,000 or $5,000 that they own to fight them.
Well, sure, and don't think that hadn't been sitting in that, you know, $2 or $3 million in a contingency fund earns a tidy little bit of interest.
Yeah, it does. Yeah, it does.
And if they have to pay that out, I would imagine that post-judgment interest goes along with it.
I would say so.
Oh, my God. Well, you know, Kenny mentioned that folks can come out and stand on the picket line. They can help with food. They can help with cash. You know, I imagine, you know, just hearing from people in other parts of the country that know about this and letting these nurses know that they're not alone, that people, you know, that people in California, Oregon, Washington, people in New York, people in, all over the nation, sending their words of support and the nurses knowing that they've got their backs, as it were, would have to be fairly meaningful, too.
It is meaningful. It's very meaningful. You know, you stand out there and hear the horns blowing and the people, and, it's inspiring, you know. And, you know, the most ironic thing about this is the history of this area and the history of those hospitals. Those hospitals were started by the United Mine Workers.
John L. Lewis was on the premises. John L. Lewis was on the premises the day the doors opened.
Yes, he was. Yes, he was. And now, you know, they have, you know, these corporate bastards is what they are, and Emmett Pugh is one of them, you know, along with my good friend the priest.
Oh, is...
You know, I mean, they're...
Oh, is the Padre involved with this?
Oh, he supports the mayor.
Well, okay, yeah.
You know, he supports the mayor.
Yeah, I mean, the mayor's like the ventriloquist dummy sitting on his lap. We understand that.
Yeah, me and him had a real good conversation the other day. I'll have to... I got that on tape, too.
Oh, the beauty...
Well, I'm glad they're not listening. You know, I mean, these poor people don't know the law. Yeah.
Yeah, you know, I mean, I might have to call the dude a weasel again, and he'd probably have to go and cry on that fundamentalist general manager's shoulder or something.
You know, West Virginia, and, you know, I don't know. It seems like there's 36 or 38 states as they have a one-person law, you know.
Yeah.
As long as one person involved in the conversation knows that the conversation is being taped.
And consents thereto.
Yes.
And I'm sure you consented.
And that would be me, and I did consent. I even signed my own little form for myself.
Good for you.
Yeah.
I hope there was no arm twisting involved.
None at all. None at all.
Well, you know, when you talk to them, when you talk to the nurses, Wayne, please tell them that I, my family, the Horn family, is behind them 100%.
Listen, you know what we need one of these days when we get rich?
What's that?
You know how, like, you know, the different radio stations got them trucks, like their boom boxes or stuff like that.
Yeah, yeah.
We need to get ourselves one of them and be able to get the signal and all that stuff and then broadcast it live at picket.
You know what? I would bet you.
At picket line.
I would bet you there's wireless internet inside of that hospital.
I wouldn't doubt that a bit.
And if you had a laptop and a set of speakers,
yeah,
there you are.
I'm going to have to research that, Bob.
Do that. I'll get with you, and I'll help you. You know, there's a jillion ways to get this program now. Were you listening the other night when I talked about what Ben Birch has accomplished?
I don't believe so.
You know, Nokia cell phones?
Yeah.
They're starting a network listing of internet radio stations for Nokia cell phone owners.
Is that right?
Yeah. Guess who's on it?
Usens. All right.
That Ben Birch. He's
so what's that now? Does that cost you minutes?
I'm so far behind the curve on cell phone internet, I don't know.
Okay.
But, you know, you can, depending on what kind...
just get one of them endless minute plans.
Yeah, yeah.
Or whatever.
As long as you're signed up for wireless internet.
Okay. Well, that's exciting.
Yeah, it is.
That's exciting.
So, you know, there are cell phones now that come with, USB attachments where you plug the little cord in the bottom of the phone and you plug the other end into your computer, into your laptop, bang, internet, boom, there's the horn.
Well, listen, we're going to have to talk about that.
Okay, okay.
And, you know, maybe one of these days when I deliver your box of screws or whatever the hell you've got shaking around in that box.
You know, that just sounds wrong, Wayne.
Oh, well, then people don't know our previous conversation. Bob ordered a bunch of computer screws, and they came to my house.
Yes.
And I figured it was a bunch of computer stuff that was broken because they're rattling all over the place.
Oh, my God, the life we lead.
I don't know if they understand that, but whatever.
Yeah, we'll talk about all that. Well, you know, hell, if you're still awake after the program ends, give me a shout while I'm producing Peter, and I can help you out a little bit.
I will be there. I'll do that.
All right, man. We'll be talking to you. Thanks for being there for the nurses.
Hello, everybody listening.
Yeah.
And, you know.
Yeah. Chat room says hey.
Okay, man.
All right. Talk to you later, Wayne.
Bye.
Bye. You know what? If I was on strike, I can't think of one human being that I would more rather have in my corner than that man. He won't say so, but he has been integral in helping these folks deal with this strike situation. And, you know, there's not 10 cents worth of give up in Wayne Revich. And if he's on the picket line with you, I'd say your chances of success go up about 100%. That's how it is. So we'll be back after the news, and maybe we'll check in with the Democratic debate brought to you by Clean Coal Technology right after this. You're listening to The Horn. You're listening to America's pro-labor liberal voice. I'm Bob Kincaid.
Well, I had just got out from the county prison doing 90 days for non-support. Tried to find me an executive position, but no matter how smooth I talk, they wouldn't listen to the fact that I was a genius. The man said we got all that we can use. Now I got them steadily depressing, low down mind messing, working at the car wash too.
This is the Quality News Network. House members passed a $50 billion spending plan last night, tied to a U.S. troop withdrawal by the end of next year. But the bill may not pass the Senate, and even if it does, President Bush has promised a veto. Most congressional Democrats say they won't pass a funding measure unless it contains a timetable for bringing troops home within the next 12 months. Defense Secretary Robert Gates warned Congress this morning that if they do not pass a war spending bill, the result could include massive layoffs at U.S. military bases funded by the Pentagon. Gates insists that the jobs of as many as 100,000 civil service workers could be at risk if representatives don't come up with legislation soon. The U.S. military says that the number of roadside bomb attacks decreased last month in Iraq. A U.S. general credits Iran's commitment to stop the flow of weapons into Iraq as one of the reasons for that drop. The new Iraqi government must come up with a new power-sharing arrangement soon or face the consequences alone. U.S. military officials overseeing the war point to an existing window of opportunity during a current decrease in attacks in Iraq. The U.S. commander of daily operations says so far, Iraqi government leaders have failed to come together. Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas called for the overthrow of the Hamas leaders in Gaza today. His comments preface next month's Middle Eastern Peace Summit to be held in Annapolis, Maryland. Former Pakistani Prime Minister Benazir Bhutto, released from house arrest after several days of detainment, she will participate in an upcoming rally against President Pervez Musharraf's emergency rule. Bhutto will be under heavy guard but will be able to move around wherever she likes, according to Pakistani authorities. Super slugger Barry Bonds, indicted by a federal grand jury on charges of perjury and obstruction of justice. He is accused of lying to a federal grand jury about his use of steroids, something he has denied for many years. Defense attorneys say Bonds will enter a not guilty plea. So far, there's been no official comment from Major League Baseball. Authorities in Bangladesh evacuating millions as a powerful tropical cyclone heads toward the country. The storm-packed winds exceeding 150 miles per hour as it sweeps through the Bay of Bengal earlier this morning. You're listening to the Quality News Network. We'll take a look at science and business news just ahead, but first, this message.
PM Forney is on a mission to make life better. His pathway is civility. A professor at Johns Hopkins University, his pioneering study in civility produced a book called Choosing Civility, The 25 Rules of Considerate Conduct. In his book, Forney explains what is civility and what it means to be civil in today's world. He explores the recent decline of civility and offers ways that the direction might be reversed. His brilliant and engaging discourse outlines civility's basic rules, underscoring the values that practicing civility brings to our own lives, as well as to the lives of others. Forney's book is sprinkled with stimulating quotes, such as this by Dwight Curry, who said, "We have a choice about how we behave, and that means we have the choice to opt for civility and grace." For more information, click the Civility button on our website, qualitynewsnetwork.com.
A new and virulent strain of a virus which causes the common cold spreading quickly across the U.S. 10 people have died from the new strain. 2 of those were infants. Dozens have been hospitalized, some in intensive care. Health experts say the next step is to gauge the size of the outbreak and to figure out where it's headed next. A Hawaiian state judge approving a plan to allow a new inter-island high-speed ferry to operate even before an environmental study is complete. The judge cited a recent law adopted by the state legislature for his decision. Opponents fear damage to local waters and marine life. In France, unions continue a nationwide transport strike, workers protesting economic reforms of the pension system. Private equity group Gala Capital and a group of Spanish investors today presented an acquisition bid for Spain's major airline Iberia. The bid estimated to be between $5 and $5.5 billion. Vehicles made by Ford and Honda rated the safest in annual highway safety agency tests. The number of new cars rated as tops in safety tripled compared to this time last year. Light sweet crude at $93.43 a barrel. At today's close of Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average dropping 121 points to end at 13,110. NASDAQ down 26 points. S&P 500 off 19. There's always more on our website at qualitynewsnetwork.com. I'm Barbara Lewis.
Tonight's final hour of Head On begins now. 1-877-4-HEAD-ON. That's 1-877-443-2366. Here's Buck.
Yes, indeed. You know, there's a... Well, I tell you what, let's see if I can make this happen through the magic of the Internet. Let's run over here and click this and see if we can see what the Democrats are saying at this fabulous coal-sponsored debate in fabulous Las Vegas. Senator Obama is speaking.
We're going to get back on health care shortly because we have a lot more to talk about.
I want Senator Edwards
to weigh in because you've spoken about the politics of parsing and your criticism of Senator Clinton. I want you to explain what that means.
Sounds like it may be a little nasty.
Nobody on this stage is perfect, and that certainly includes me. And I don't claim perfection, far from it.
What I would say is that the issue is whether we can have a president that can for the American people in the president of the United States. Because I think this president has destroyed that trust, and I think there are fair questions to be asked of all of us, including Senator Clinton. Senator Clinton says she will end the war. She also says she will continue to keep combat troops in Iraq and continue combat missions in Iraq. She says she will turn up the heat on George Bush and the Republicans. But when the crucial vote came on stopping Bush, Cheney, and the neocons on Iran, she voted with Bush and Cheney. On the issue of Social Security, she said, standing beside me on the stage, that she would not do anything about the cap on Social Security taxes, and she has said privately to people, because it's been reported in the press, that in fact she would consider raising that cap. And the most important issue is she says she will bring change to Washington while she continues to defend a system that does not work, that is broken, that is rigged, and is corrupt. Corrupted against the interest of most Americans, and corrupted.
Oh my!
A very small, very powerful, very well-financed. We have fundamental differences.
We're going to get to all of these issues, including energy and Iran and everything else. Senator Clinton, I'll let you respond because there was a direct charge made against you. Then we're going to bring in everybody. Everyone's going to get time tonight. Don't worry, we got a lot.
Oh yeah, Wolf. Sure.
Go ahead.
Well, you know, I respect all of my colleagues on this stage, and you know we're Democrats, and we're trying to nominate the very best person we can to win. And I don't mind taking hits on my record on issues, but when somebody starts throwing mud, at least we can hope that it's both accurate and not right out of the Republican playbook. Because what I believe is important is that we.
I think she just called John Edwards a Republican.
Active for 35 years. The American people know where I stand. You know, Senator Edwards raised health care again. When Senator Edwards ran in 2004, he wasn't for universal health care. I'm glad he is now. But for him to be throwing this mud and making these charges, I think really detracts.
You know, one of the things that let's be careful about throwing this universal health care around because
I know that the person who's speaking, Senator Clinton, her health care plan is mobbed up with the insurance industry. Senator Obama's is mobbed up with the insurance industry. Virtually everybody except Dennis Kucinich, who is a co-sponsor of H.R. 676, the Medicare for All bill, has the insurance industry profiting from the illness of American citizens tucked away into their health care plans. Is that tolerable to you? Oh, wait. Well, oh, Joe Biden's speaking. Oh, this ought to be fun. You know, he opens his mouth and the bats fly out.
At their tables tonight, they put their kids to bed, and they're worrying about whether or not their child's going to run into a drug dealer on the way to school. They're worrying about whether or not they're going to be able to pay for their mortgage, because even if they didn't have one of those subprime mortgages, things are looking bad for them. They're worrying about whether they're going to keep their job, and they're worrying about whether their son in the National Guard is going to get killed in Iraq. Ladies and gentlemen, look, every political campaign gets to this place, and I'm not criticizing any of the three people who are the ones who always get to talk all the time at these things. I'm not. I'm not criticizing. But look, folks, let's get straight to it here. This is not about experience. It's not about change. It's about action. Who among us is going to be able to, on day one, step in and end the war? Who among us understands what to do about Pakistan? Who among us is going to pick up the phone and immediately interface with Putin and tell him to lay off Georgia because Shalabi?
Okay, so far that's three questions and they're all answered, Dennis.
I have 35 years of experience. While everyone's talking about their experience and Hillary has great experience,
I don't know who did his eyebrows, but you know what? He's looking like a Romulan tonight, Biden is.
I was passing. Yeah, you're right.
I think we've got a rowdy audience going here.
Let me just point out, everyone's going to have plenty of time tonight. I want John Roberts to go ahead and ask the next question, and then we'll bring everybody in, I promise.
Senator Clinton, you were saying just a moment ago...
Ba-dum-bum.
The question's not going to her, by the way. Reiterating what you said. You said you're not... You think it's legitimate for you to take hits on your record. Well, some of those hits on your record have come from the far right-hand side of the stage, from Senator Edwards, who has frequently...
From the far right-hand side of the stage.
But, Senator, you have...
Well, he just sort of followed up on the John Edwards is a Republican meme now, didn't he?
You were for the Iraq War before you were against it. People change their positions. If it's fair for you to change your position, is it not fair for her to change hers?
It's absolutely fair, but... It's absolutely fair for people to learn from their experience and grow and mature and change. Anybody who's not willing to change based on what they learn is ignorant. And everybody ought to be willing to do that. That's not what I'm saying. I'm saying there's a difference between that and saying two contrary things at exactly the same time. I mean, for example, just over the course of the last week, Senator Clinton said in Washington that she would vote for the Peru trade deal, and she said in Iowa, talking to union members, that she wanted a moratorium on trade deals. The important thing about this, though, is none of us, because the reality is, and I want to add on to something that Joe Biden said. You know, before I came over here tonight, I was thinking, we're going to have this debate. When we finish, all of you are going to be on television saying, oh, who scored points? Who won the debate? All of us are going to be fine. The question is, will America be fine? Because what I saw before we came over here, on your troll underneath the screen, 35 million Americans last year went hungry. 37 million people in this country live in poverty every day. 47 million Americans have no health care coverage. And there is a fundamental choice that everyone in this room and Democratic voters have to make. And that is, who do you believe will take on this system and change it so that it's no longer rigged, corrupt, and rigged against the interests of the American people? That is the fundamental choice. And I think people are entitled to know that they have choices. There's nothing personal about this. This is about what America needs to be. This is about those 35 million people who are hungry every single year. When is our party going to show a little backbone and strength and courage and speak up?
Fair questions, every last one of them.
Left behind? All right, hold on one second. I want Senator Dodd to weigh in. Senator Dodd, because you said, made a statement earlier in the week, and I'm quoting you now, you're surprised at just how angry Senator Edwards has become, and you suggest that he's not the same person
Always angry. It's bad to be angry. We can't be angry.
And elaborate. Tell us what you mean.
Well, you're not angry. You're not paying attention.
First of all, we Democrats have a job to do, and that is to unite this party, attract independents, Republicans who are seeking change, to join us 12 months from now and elect a Democrat into the White House and to hold on to the House and Senate. That's number one. And it's going to take more than just getting people in our own party to support us. We're going to have to reach out. There's a shrillness to the debate. The American people want results. They want the job done. Exactly what Joe Biden talked about here. When people get up in the morning and go to work, they sit around and they worry about their jobs, their retirement, their health care, their kids' education, and they wonder if anybody in Washington is paying any attention to them and whether or not the job is being done on their behalf. And frankly, when a campaign is about turning up the heat or who's angrier or who's yelling louder, the American people turn off in terms of listening. They want us to...
By God, somebody better yell. It's yelling time. This is not the time for that civility lecture, Senator Dodd. Jesus, we have to yell. These are yelling issues. Bill Richardson.
Anyway, I'm Bill Richardson. I'm governor of New Mexico. Nice to meet you all.
Apparently we're 25 minutes in, and it's the first time Bill Richardson's been allowed to speak. That tells me Dennis probably hasn't been allowed yet.
It seems that Barack wants to start a generational war. It seems that Senator Clinton, with all due respect on her plan on Iraq, doesn't end the war. All I want to do is give peace a chance. And I say that because these are the fundamental issues. Do our plans end the war?
Had to criticize Senator Clinton there because he's been working so hard to get the VP nomination.
Do our plans give health care to every American? Are we creating jobs and economic growth? Are we resolving the real problems affecting this country? You know, let's stop this mudslinging. Let's stop this going after each other.
Kumbaya, my lord, kumbaya. You know, the fact of the matter is, every person standing up there, I mean, just listen to him speak. Every single person standing up there is about, a million light years past more articulate than the thing that sits in the White House. I feel fairly good about the majority of them. I just disagree with, I mean, the war got to end, right?
I understand all of you Democrats. Are you ready to commit absolutely, positively, that you will support the Democratic nominee no matter who that nominee is?
Oh, for the love of God.
No ifs, ands, or buts. Senator Edwards.
Is that a planted question?
Yes. I planted it.
Yes, I absolutely will support the Democratic nominee for president.
Absolutely. Yes.
Absolutely, yes.
Only if they oppose war as an instrument of policy.
There you go, Dennis.
Yes, I will support the nominee.
Hell no, I wouldn't support any of these guys. No, I'm joking. Of course, support them all. Campbell, go ahead.
All right, let's talk about the issue. Senator Obama, I want to ask you about immigration. It's an important issue in this state in particular. There are between 100,000 to 200,000 illegal immigrants here in Nevada. And you've supported various benefits for illegal immigrants, including driver's licenses and in-state college tuition. What do you say to those Americans who say they are losing out because you would give benefits to people who broke the laws of this country, who came here illegally? And then more generally, as president, where do you draw the line when it comes to benefits for illegal immigrants?
I would say that they're justified in feeling frustrated because this administration, the Bush administration, has done nothing to control the problem that we have. We've had 5 million undocumented workers come over the borders since George Bush took office. It has become an extraordinary problem. And the reason the American people are concerned is because they are seeing their own economic position slip away. And oftentimes, employers are exploiting these undocumented workers. They're not paying the minimum wage. They're not observing worker safety laws. And so what we have to do is create a comprehensive solution to the problem. Now, I have already stated that as president, I will make sure that we finally have the kind of border security that we need. That's step number one. Step number two is to take on employers. Right now, an employer has more of a chance of getting hit by lightning than be prosecuted for hiring an undocumented worker. That has to change. They have to be held accountable. And when we do those things...
All right, let's check out the phones real quick. We've got our good friend Jim. Hey, Jim, welcome to the program.
Hey, Bob, how's it going?
It's going. It's going.
I hear you. You know, this may be just teamed in, but that's what's going on. But I heard you mention our TIC leader, and, you know, I remember having seen that movie, JFK. Ever see that film?
Yeah, the Oliver Stone film?
Right.
Yeah.
Well, do you remember the conversation Donald Sutherland had with Kevin Costner up there on the top of the mall?
Oh, yeah, sitting on the bench there?
Mm-hmm. And the question he asked him, what is the most powerful and dominant method to organize the fight and to basically make it coalesce? And his answer was war. And that's the reason these people have had such a stranglehold on this country. It's because of this war. That's the reason they precipitated it. And the fear of 9/11 two years before that. I mean, this is their main power grasp on this nation. And its thought processes, its media, its economy, and everything. Because war is the most powerful and galvanizing means of organizing society and making it bend to your will. And that's what has been happening here for the past 7 years. In my opinion, I might be wrong.
No, I don't think you are. I don't think you are. I think you're absolutely right. It's what Dennis Kucinich just said on that debate stage. They asked the question, you know, will you unconditionally support whoever is the Democratic nominee? And Dennis Kucinich said, only if that nominee promises not to use war as an extension of public policy.
Well, that's what of course that's what war is by definition, according to von Clausewitz. But in this case, it is an extension of national policy, and that's what. But it's been what I contend.
But it's not for national security. It is for purposes of what you described, Jim. It is for purposes of manipulating the American people.
Well, that's what it's being used for now. I think what von Clausewitz said, he was meaning that you were projecting your own power onto the face of another country. But here, it's being projected not only in other parts of the world, but very much here at home. And really, you can't have one without the other.
Well, now that the Iraq War is longer than World War II, at least the American portion of it, is there any doubt left, Jim, that the Iraq War is a whole lot more about the American people than it is the Iraqi ones? After all, we got rid of their hated leader, but we're still in a war with them. What does that tell you?
Well, it tells us that our policy there is hideously flawed. And we should never have gone to war with him in the first place. But how many times have I said on this show that Saddam was a secular leader, and when we went over there, we just stirred up a hornet's nest, riled up a whole bunch of fundamentalists. I mean, he wasn't any love child, that's for sure. But at least, you know, at one time, he was our son of a bitch. And at least, we didn't have all this crap going over that's going over there now.
Jim, I've got a news story here about a woman in Saudi Arabia who got gang raped, okay? She was sentenced to 200 lashes for getting gang raped. Her punishment was enhanced because she dared to shine media attention on her plight. Those are our buddies.
Well, those people are crazy over there. I mean, you know, I've heard Godbolt talk on his show about people who are gagging 7,000, and then they revive them so they can give them, I guess, a couple hundred more. Well, God, I think if you got the right man holding the right kind of whip, but now 25 is enough to kill you. I mean, I don't know. It's just those people over there. I mean, you show your feet to one of them, you got a man who's going to kill you.
She was.
I mean, I'm familiar with that part of the world, Desert Storm.
She was kidnapped and gang raped, and she was sentenced to prison for being in an automobile not belonging to one of her male relatives.
So they're saying, according to their way of thinking, that she was asking for. Is that what they're trying to say?
You know, I can't even countenance the idea. But I suppose so. Or maybe what they're saying
is that they are barbaric.
They are.
Baseline human at best, and trapped in the 9th century B.C.
Well, I hate to say it, but I mean, for a country that's supposedly been subjected to Western civilization and Western money and stuff like that, that they should be so backward, but I guess that's just the way it is. But
they're not backwards, Jim. They're just evil.
Well, backwardness and all those other things contribute to the level of evil, I guess, is what I'm trying to say. But, you know, this country has been just totally paralyzed and gripped to the talons of war, which has paralyzed its policies abroad and at home. I mean, you know, it's gotten our resources so strung out that we can't take care of our own people when a hurricane hits. God only knows what would happen if an earthquake or some other natural disaster would hit. I mean, our geologists have been talking about Yellowstone going crazy for years. And, you know, it's just, I don't know. And I think the principal factor underneath the whole thing is greed. Because you've got more contractors over there in Iraq than you do soldiers.
Yes.
And, you know, money being the petrol of life, everybody wants to go over there and get in on the action and make a lot of money tax-free. And it's our own greed or their own greed or whoever's running the show. I don't know who's running the show. Now, I can't tell you. Hell, if you line me up against the wall and ask me to give you a straight answer and have a gun against me, I probably would be hit the dirt in about 5 seconds because I couldn't give you one, you know?
I know.
I could. Hell, if I could, I'd be over there across the Potomac doing something. But I don't know. It's just nuts. And the thing about it is, I don't know what they're going to do about Iran. That's frightening to me, and we've talked about that. I mean, they talked about a robust attack to continue this war so they can continue a stranglehold
right
on everybody, and that's equally disconcerting to me.
As it should be. As it should be.
And really. And but, I mean, you get to the point where you see all you can do is vote. That's about all I can do is vote. I contact D.C. at least 2 or 3 times a week about different things. And even the people I talk to up there, they just say, what the hell can you do? I hear that 2 or 3 times a week from 2 or 3 different congressmen, aides, staffers, and people like that. You know, when I present the same types of arguments I presented to you, they said, I agree with you. You're right. But there ain't nothing we can do about it. And I asked them, I said, well, if you can't, who can?
Well, that's the thing, though. They're in that defeated mode, Jim, and there is something they can do about it. But all they have to, but they lack the essential ingredient to be able to do the one thing they can, and that is courage. Because it takes a little bit of courage to look at the Constitution and stand with the men and women who have bled and died for that document over the years.
Well, yeah, you're right.
And impeach this little jug-eared, pig-eyed SOB in the White House. That's what you can do about it.
Well, unfortunately, I don't think that's going to happen. He's going to see out his term until January of 2009. And that is, if something else hasn't happened, and I don't know. Looking at history the way I look at it, constitutions have been manipulated in the past to allow people to come to power who shouldn't. You know what I'm talking about, too. I mean, look what happened to
certainly
the Weimar. Look what happened to the Weimar Constitution in 1933.
Yeah, manipulated is a gentle term for it. Yes,
they had a good constitution over there. I mean, you know, they had a bad economy because of the World Depression. But I mean, you know, but I mean, of course, it was manipulated, and that very same constitution put Adolf Hitler in power. And I'm just afraid we're going to have an extension of something like that happening over here.
You know what wakes me, Jim? What wakes me up in the middle of the night is when I realize that every time we get a bad president, we tend to say as a people, well, he's gone now. We can't possibly have one any worse than him. We said it with Nixon. We said it with Reagan.
Oh, listen, they...
And then we get George W. Bush. And now, toward the end of that little weasel's term, we're saying, well, you know, but he's gone in January 2009. And, you know, we'll never make that mistake again. We are the American people, Jim. And you can bet your last dollar that we will find a man who will make George W. Bush look like an absolute genius. It is guaranteed.
Where are they going to be looking for him? Some asylum?
There's plenty of dust out there, I guess. You're right. I don't know.
Well, I mean, look at the people running for the presidency on the Republican side of the aisle. Look at Tom Tancredo. You know, when Barry Goldwater put out his nuclear bomb, what was the phrase? Jim, you know it and I don't. But the nuclear bomb ad, and then
I know what you're talking about. I can't think of it.
And then the LBJ campaign
You know he's right.
Yeah, and the LBJ campaign came back and said, yeah, in your heart you know he's right, but in your gut you know he's nuts.
I remember seeing those ads when I was like 18 or 19 years old.
The Daisy ad, sure. What I'm getting at here, you know, where are we going to find him? He's all over the Republican Party.
Well, when I see people like Fred Thompson, I said,
Rudy Giuliani.
Oh yeah, I mean, you know, good Lord.
Tancredo's out there with an ad now that shows the backs of people wearing backpacks and hooded sweatshirts talking about the Arab terrorists loose among us. You know, it's a sickening level of fear-mongering. But, you ask where we're going to find him. There's 8 or 9 or 10 or 11 of them running for the Republican nomination right now, and any one of them could conceivably get in there and make George Bush look like a genius.
Well, I'll tell you one of the ones that I'm the most familiar with, Fred Thompson. And he's just a specter. He's just some type of horrible apparition. The first time I ever saw him, I think, was in The Hunt for Red October. And then I saw him in Roseanne, when he was Roseanne's supervisor. And he was so ugly to her, and such a misogynist, that he made her quit her job. And the moral of that show was to show what an asshole this guy was. And the biggest asshole that's ever been portrayed on her show of 10 years is Fred Thompson. And he loved that role. He loved it.
Maybe it was near and dear to his heart, Jim.
Well, I'm sure he probably had a Woody when he was doing it.
No, I don't even want to.
Some people get off on that guy.
My eyes, Jim. My eyes.
What do you mean?
No, I mean I didn't. You know, TMI. I got a mental image in my head now that's going to be days getting rid of.
I mean, some people really get off on that kind of stuff.
Well, sure.
I mean, you know, I don't know what's between his ears and what kind of charges are firing of synapses in his head or any of the rest of them. I mean, but I mean, some of the stuff I hear is just what I call what that McCullough said to that German commander at Bastogne. Nuts.
Yeah.
Just crazy ass nuts. And I just don't understand how people like that can rise to a position of prominence, but, you know, they do. You know what floats?
And the stuff that floats rolls downhill, too. Thanks, Jim. Good to talk to you.
You too. Bye.
Bye now. They are. They're crazier than a sprayed roach. Let's check back in for a minute and see what's shaking. Biden.
I think you should demand more of the teachers in terms of the participation after school and in school. But I think you've got to pay them. And the last point I'll make is Bill is correct. You have to, look, the idea you start teachers at $28,000 in most states, when in the countries we're competing with, they start off and they graduate, the graduating seniors are getting the same pay that engineers are getting in those same schools. My father has an expression, God love him, before he passed away, he'd say, don't tell me what you value, show me your budget, and I will tell you what you value. I've laid out a $30 billion plan over 5 years to pay 16 years of education is what our kids need. They need to start 2 years earlier and be guaranteed 2 years after school.
Thank you, Senator. Campbell Brown.
Senator Biden.
Yep.
A question on Pakistan. As you know, in the past few weeks, Pakistani leader Pervez Musharraf has declared a state of emergency there. He's dismissed several Supreme Court justices. He's recently placed opposition leader Benazir Bhutto under house arrest twice now and imprisoned numerous other
Yeah. We know. We follow the news.
Last week. And you, along with several others on this stage, assert that the U.S. Should maintain its current level of financial support for Pakistan. And my question is, is it your view that there are times when the security of the United States is more important than the way a key ally like Musharraf disregards freedom and disregards democracy.
First of all, I do not think we should maintain the same aid we're giving. I have made it clear to Musharraf personally when he called me, and I've spoken personally to Bhutto. Before, I might add, the president spoke to either one of them. I spoke to them, and I indicated very clearly two things. One, if he did not take off his uniform, if he did not hold fair and free elections by the middle of January, I would, on the floor of the Senate, move to take away the aid we're giving with regard to F-16s and P-3s. Because that's the biggest leverage you have in him within his military. He is not a sole player. He has to keep his military happy as well. I would use that leverage. Secondly, I've indicated that what we should do is move from a Musharraf policy to a Pakistan policy. Unlike anyone else, within 5 days of this happening, I laid out a detailed plan. The president hasn't. No one on the stage has. No one else has. A detailed plan as president, how I would proceed with Iraq. And you have to move from military aid to giving the middle class there. The middle class is overwhelmingly the majority. They get no connection with the United States. We have to significantly increase our economic aid relative to education, relative to NGOs, relative to all those things that make a difference in the lives of ordinary people over there, and not be doing it through the military side. I know there's more to say, Campbell. I appreciate you asking me the question, and I'm sorry I answered it. I know you're not supposed to answer questions based on what I've
heard. Well, let me bring in Governor Richardson. Governor Richardson, You've suggested cutting off military aid to Pakistan.
This is apparently the snark debate.
Leader doesn't take these steps to restore the Constitution, take off his military uniform, end the national state of emergency, and have free and fair elections. But some are worried, including the opposition leader Benazir Bhutto. I spoke with her earlier this week, that cutting off military aid to the Pakistan military could undermine U.S. national security. This is a country that has nuclear weapons, that has a strong Taliban presence, an Al-Qaeda presence. Are you worried at all that as bad as President Musharraf might be, it could get a whole lot worse over there?
Well, of course I'm worried, but what happened with our Pakistan policy, we got our principles wrong. We forgot our principles. Our principles that we said to Musharraf, you know, Musharraf, security is more important than human rights. If I'm president, it's the other way around. Democracy and human rights. What I would do is, yes, I would condition the assistance to Musharraf. We give him $10 billion. 60% of that is to his military. I would say, President Musharraf, unless you restore the Constitution, unless you have elections in January, unless you end the state of emergency, unless you allow Benazir Bhutto to run as a candidate, unless you put the Supreme Court back, and something else we forgot, he is supposed to go after terrorists on his border. And he has done a very weak job of doing that. And, you know, I would condition the assistance. But here's another point. In Pakistan, in the politics of Pakistan, Islamic parties get maybe 15% of the vote. I mean, so this threat that, revolutionary elements are going to overtake him, if he has a fair election and you take his party and Benazir Bhutto's party and you get the military, but I believe that moderate forces can win. So if we're on the side of democracy and human rights and we're on the side of Musharraf having elections, then U.S. interests are preserved, and the Pakistani people have a democracy.
Let me just be precise, because I want to make sure I heard you correctly. What you're saying, Governor, is that human rights, at times, are more important than American national security?
Yes.
American national security is human rights.
We need to find ways to say to the world that, you know, it's not.
That's
just
how we've
about
survived these 230 years or so, isn't it?
It's also about our values of freedom, equality. Our strength is not just military and economic. Our strength as a nation is our values. Equality, freedom, democracy, human rights.
Senator Edwards,
that's
I want
why
you to weigh
we
in.
Are strong.
Go ahead, Senator.
Well, I think, first of all, we have some basic goals that we need to be focused on with respect to Pakistan. One is to make sure that the extremists in northwest Pakistan are under control. Second, that we provide support for the democratic reformers. Third is, as Senator Biden just spoke about, to make sure these elections take place in January. And fourth, we need to make certain that the nuclear weapons are under control. Now, this leads to a bigger question.
I think Pakistan is the living, breathing example that America's ad hoc policy of dealing with the spread of nuclear weapons, while it's absolutely required in today's world, given what's happening with Iran, given what we see today in Pakistan and the incredible fragility of the administration in Pakistan and the presence of an extraordinary extremist element within Pakistan. But this is the living, breathing example of a policy that will not work over the long term. I'm about to finish. What we have to do, what America needs to do, and what I will do as President of the United States is to lead a long-term international effort to rid the world of nuclear weapons. It is the only way we're going to keep the world secure and keep America
Everybody's going to have a chance. Senator Obama, is human rights more important than American national security?
The concepts are not contradictory, Wolf.
Because occasionally they could clash.
They are complementary. And I think Pakistan is a great example. Look, we paid $10 billion over the last 7 years. And we had two goals, deal with terrorism and restore democracy, and we've gotten neither. And Joe and Bill are exactly right on this. Pakistan's democracy would strengthen our battle against extremists. The more we see repression, the more there are no outlets for how people can express themselves and their aspirations, the worse off we're going to be. And the more anti-American sentiment there's going to be in the Middle East. We keep on making this mistake. As president, I will do everything that is required to make sure that nuclear weapons don't fall into the hands of extremists, especially going after Al-Qaeda in the hills between Afghanistan and Pakistan. But we've got to understand that if we simply prop up anti-democratic practices, that feeds the sense that America is only concerned about us and that our fates are not tied to these other folks. And that's going to make us less safe. That's something I intend to change.
Well, Hold on one second. Senator Dodd, I want you to weigh in. What's more important when they clash, human rights versus national security?
Well, first of all, I hope maybe other people find it as ironic as I do that have President Bush urging the Turks not to invade the Kurdish areas of Iraq and lecturing Musharraf about restoring the Constitution. This is an administration that stepped all over our own Constitution in the process. And this isn't. Elections are, there's an expression in Spanish that says,
so what's more important, human rights or national security?
Well, obviously, national security, keeping the country safe. When you take the oath of office on January 20th, you promise to do two things, and that is to protect and defend the Constitution of the United States and protect our country against enemies, both foreign and domestic. The security of the country is number one, obviously, here.
Okay.
All right. Now, secondly, this doesn't mean elections are only one note, as they say, the tune of democracy here. Be careful what you wish for. If there were totally free elections, and many of these countries we're talking about today, the Islamic Jihad or the Islamic Brotherhood will win 85% of the vote. That's not a great outcome for us at this point here.
All right.
So we need to have a sense of balance about this here. I disagree with those who suggest here that we ought to condition Musharraf's actions regarding some of these issues on aid and assistance here. There's only one way into Afghanistan. It's through Pakistan. The generals and the military control the nuclear weaponry here. We need to move and remind Musharraf that there are obligations he needs to fulfill. Be careful here about insisting upon...
Let me
finish, Musharraf, because literally, then you have to do what you say you're going to do. And if he doesn't do what he's suggesting, then you have to terminate that relationship, and that puts this country in a very, very dangerous position.
You say national security is more important than human rights. Senator Clinton, what do you say?
I agree with that completely. I mean,
I
the first
really
obligation of the President of the United States is to protect and defend the United States of America. That doesn't mean that it is to the exclusion of other interests. And there's absolutely a connection between a democratic regime and heightened security for the United States. That's what's so tragic about this situation. After 9/11, President Bush had a chance to chart a different course, both in Pakistan and in Afghanistan, and could have been very clear about what our expectations were. We are now in a bind. And it is partly, not completely, but partly a result of the failed policies of the Bush administration. So where we are today means that we have to say to President Musharraf, look, this is not in your interest either. This is not in the interest of the United States. It is not in your interest to either stay in power or stay alive. We have to figure out how we're going to navigate this. When I was meeting with him earlier this year, I asked him if he would accept a high-level presidential envoy to begin to negotiate some of these issues. He said, yes, I got back. I called the White House. I asked them to send such a high-level envoy. They did not do it. They're going to send one now. So, I mean, you've got to stay on top of this, and you have to manage it all the time. That requires presidential attention. We haven't had
that.
And part of the reason is obvious now.
John Roberts.
Hello.
Hello?
Stand by. John Roberts, go ahead. You're going to have a chance.
All right. To Governor Richardson, a military
I'll be damned.
Unit from the Nevada National Guard stationed about 12
That was Dennis Kucinich saying, hello.
Tour of duty.
Wolf just blew right by him. You're going to have a chance.
The effect of the troop increase over there. It's true that 2007 is the biggest year
wrestling.
So far since 2003 for American forces. But it's also true that U.S. troop deaths have been declining steadily since the spring. And in fact, in the month of October, they were at their lowest level.
I kind of hate to end the show this
way.
But
at the same time, there has been a marked decline in the number of deaths.
I don't know what Dennis Kucinich would have said.
General David Petraeus,
Wolf Blitzer made it abundantly apparent that he didn't give a tinker's damn what Wolf Blitzer or what Dennis Kucinich would have said. And I'll offer you odds that it would have been the sanest single statement made by any of the people on that stage. God, this is frustrating. God, this is annoying. So we'll just make CNN go away now. Probably should have earlier. Finish with a couple of minutes here that you might find interesting. It is my position that the single best columnist in America right now isn't Paul Krugman, isn't anybody at the New York Times. It's Mark Morford out in San Francisco. And this column has a special relevance, given what we've been dealing with for what seems so long. He says, I know how it is. You've had it up to here. There are only so many stories about blood and death and pain you can take. Only so many times you can hear about random shootings and corporate malfeasance and how Bushko's squad of scabrous flying monkeys have, say, supported torture or endorsed wiretapping or gouged the nation for another $200 billion to pay for a failed war. Your nerves are raw and your heart is tired and the media will just not shut the hell up already about the sadness and the war and the mayhem and the genie and the doom, doom, doom. It is outrage fatigue, and it is epidemic. It is that feeling that we are being hammered, unlike any time in recent history, with so many appalling and disgusting and violently un-American incidents and scandals and manipulations that our BS detectors are smoking like an old V8 engine on a hot summer's day, and it's all we can do to get up every day without screaming. What's more, it's not the mere quantity of moral insults either. It's the bizarre absurdity of the subject matter, the things we're being forced to consider or reconsider that seem to make it all so horrific. Torture? Are you kidding? Allegedly the most civilized, the most morally aware nation on the planet, and we are still debating in the highest courts and government offices in the land about whether the United States should strap human beings to gnarled metal benches in rancid foreign bunkers and inflict such inexplicable terror and fear upon them that they confess to things they didn't even do just to get us to stop? Is this the Middle Ages? Are we regressing back to the goddamn cave? Oh my, yes. Plethoric are the reasons you should be outraged indeed, and torture just might be one of the most incendiary reasons in the past few years. If nothing else, its disgusting return to U.S. political dialogue certainly means it's no time to be laying down arms in exhaustion, no matter how tempting it might be. It's a lengthy column. I encourage you to go and get it. And he says, smart, informed outrage engages you and fires your heart, your mind. It is fuel. It is the reason you claim you enjoy being an American, to question malevolent government actions and take a stand and demand accountability where there has, for the past 7 years, been none. Bottom line, we simply cannot let them convince us by way of an all-out assault on science, sex, love, et al., that the good fight just ain't worth fighting. After all, the flying monkeys are far from done raiding the closet and stealing your babies and making a mockery of everything wise and calm and open-hearted people hold dear. And baby, if you ain't outraged about that, something's very wrong indeed. Go read the column. Some of the best writing I've read in quite a while. Thanks to everybody this evening. I certainly did appreciate these 3 hours that I had a chance to get away from the insanity. And you know what? The outrage is good. I know you're tired. I know I get tired. We all get tired.
But just because you get tired doesn't mean you get to give up. Never give up. Never, ever, ever give up. I won't, if you won't. And always, 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 RMR, Gina, it's all for you.
This is the Quality News Network. Iran is making important strides toward transparency about its nuclear activities, but key questions remain unanswered. Meanwhile, Iran has significantly expanded uranium enrichment. That's according to a newly released report from the United Nations. The findings could expose Iran to harsher UN sanctions as suspicions rise that it could be making atomic bombs. The U.S. military says that the number of roadside bomb attacks decreased last month in Iraq. A U.S. general credits Iran's commitment to stop the flow of weapons into Iraq as one of the reasons for that drop. Defense Secretary Robert Gates warning Congress this morning that if they don't pass a war spending bill, the result could include massive layoffs at U.S. military bases funded by the Pentagon. Gates insists that the jobs of as many as 100,000 civil service workers could be at risk. Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas calling for the overthrow of the Hamas leaders in Gaza today. His comments preface next month's Middle Eastern Peace Summit to be held in Annapolis, Maryland. Super slugger Barry Bonds indicted by a federal grand jury today on charges of perjury and obstruction of justice. Bonds is accused of lying to a federal grand jury about his use of steroids, something he has denied for many years. Defense attorneys say Bonds will enter a not guilty plea. So far, there's been no official comment from Major League Baseball. On Capitol Hill, Republican Representative Dennis Hastert of Illinois announcing his resignation from public service today. The former Speaker of the House held the office longer than any representative in U.S. history. CNN and the Nevada Democratic Party hosting a TV debate tonight in Las Vegas for Democratic presidential candidates. Frontrunner Hillary Clinton under pressure to perform after last week's dismal showing against her male counterparts. A second earthquake striking the same area of Chile that was rocked yesterday by a 7.7 tremor. Authorities are calling today's